We're very fortunate that Harlan has agreed to come and do the Big Book Workshop. It's done in five sessions. They're each an hour and a half long starting now. So, okay, well, I'll come find you in a minute. Anyway, we have five sessions today till 10:30. Harlan will take his breaks when he wants, but hopefully he'll take them around the same time, 10:30, and then noon we break for lunch. We're back at two. And then we do another two more sessions this afternoon and another one again tomorrow morning. As you will see, people will be coming and going. You're coming and staying, hopefully. So stake out your place if you leave. Make sure someone knows that you're coming back so that you don't have to fight someone for a seat, because I assure you later in the day it will be standing room only. And with no further ado, let me please turn this over to Harlan. Everyone give Harlan a big round of applause. He came from Phoenix to do this for us today.
Thank you, Jeff.
Thank you, Jeff. I'm Harlan. I'm a compulsive overeater. And I hate to be tethered to this thing, so I'm going to probably stretch this out as much as I can. I've been a compulsive overeater from the second I was born. I'm not one of these people that all of a sudden, you know, had a baby when they were 30 and discovered they couldn't stop eating or something. That's not my story. I came into the world in very kind of crazy situation. My mother had no idea that she was even pregnant, not a clue that she was pregnant. And when I tell that in a room full of ladies, some of them like, what? But she had no clue. And my dad was 54 years old on the day that I was born. So he was 60, which is the age I am now, when I entered kindergarten. He wasn't one generation in front of me. He was really two generations in front of me. He was older than many of the grandparents of my friends. And does any of that have to do really with my compulsive overeating? Not really. It's just my story. It's just the way I came into the world. My mother was mentally ill. My mother had three extremely distinct personalities. My mother was a screaming, raving lunatic in 1 minute, and then the next minute she could just suck in some air and become like a little baby, like a 2-3-year-old person, and then she could suck in another bit of air, and she could be the most coherent person you ever spoke to in your life. She was up to date on current events. You could talk to her about books. You could talk to her about anything you wanted to talk to her about, and she was right there. And then she would suck in some more air, and she would go back into these various personalities, and you never knew quite what you were going to get. And this is the uncertainty of my life. And at a very, very early age, I became my mother's husband and my father's wife. Not in a sexual sense at all, but in the very real sense that my dad would, and they hated each other. I mean, they showed their love of each other with pots and pans flying through the air and insults flying through the air. I mean, I grew up in a war zone with the two of them. And my mother would tell me every day of my life, I hate your father. The only reason I live here is because of you. And my father would tell me every day of my life, I hate your mother. The only reason I live here is because of you. And all I really wanted to know was Huckleberry Hound going to get away from Powerful Pierre? Or was Yogi and Boo Boo going to get away with the picnic basket because Ranger Smith was coming around the corner? And that's what I was really interested in finding out. And they would tell me things like, we can't pay our bills, your father doesn't make a living, he's a bum, and your mother's crazy, and you're this. My father came to this country under very, very murderous, crazy conditions. My father was the youngest of eight children. He had grandparents on both sides. He had aunts and uncles, cousins, nieces and nephews under the age of six that were obliterated off the face of the earth through the murder and mayhem of the turn of the century Russia, the turn of the century Poland, where Europe was a graveyard for Jews. This is before World War II, when it was a graveyard for Jews at a time when the world had gone crazy. And that's the reason that I mention this to you, is because when we get into Bill's story a little later on this morning, it's going to be integral for the difficulties that I had in embracing step two. And this is going to be part of what I'm going to have as my story, thank you very much, of embracing step two. And the situation was that food was constantly something that became my friend. Food was always there. Food was always a part of my life. There was never a time when it wasn't my go-to friend or my go-to release. And what I didn't understand as a child is I understood why I ate the kind of food I ate. Really, I did. I ate it because I thought it tasted good. I thought I was hungry. But what I couldn't understand at all is, how come these other people aren't eating like me? How come they're not interested in food like me? How is it that they find some way to resist the impulse to eat? And it took me decades to understand that they don't have that impulse to eat, so they're not really fighting anything that's real. But my mother and father got screamed at a lot by people because the people were getting very unhappy about my weight. And they would scream at my mother and they would scream at my father. And then when I got to be about 5 or 6 years old, they started screaming directly at me. And they would holler at me, and sometimes they would hit me, but they always scared me. They always scared me to the point where what I learned to do when they were yelling at me about my weight was I learned to emotionally shut it down. And I learned to withstand the storm, and I learned to withstand it to the point where I knew that eventually, even though I feel like crying, and sometimes I did cry, and sometimes they made me pee my pants, and sometimes they scared me to the point where I would literally be shaking because they would get so imposing upon, you know, they were bigger than me, they were screaming at me, and there was one thing I wanted to do and one thing I wanted to be. I wanted to be what they wanted me to be. I wanted to acquiesce to their demands. I knew in my heart that they were 100% correct, that if I wouldn't eat cake and I wouldn't eat pie and I wouldn't eat brownies and I wouldn't eat cookies, that somehow my life would be better, because at that age I equated the ability to fight the impulse to eat with strength and power and intelligence. And if you are a kid growing up in my life, you sort of learn that fat equals wrong. If a fat kid says 2 and 2 is 4, and a skinny kid says 2 and 2 is 131, then the skinny kid wins because he has the trump card, and the trump card is, yeah, but you're fat. And that trump card would beat me down every single time. And so I learned at a very early age that I was not good enough. I was not enough to be thin. Something was lacking in me. And even at an early age, I didn't want to live in this world because everything I tried was failing. And I had a mother that would constantly talk about not wanting to live. So this is where I was picking up on this from. And my father had tremendous, tremendous post-traumatic stress disorder. He wasn't diagnosed during his life, but many psychologists and many psychiatrists that I have talked to about him have told me that this is PTSD. He could be right back in the murder and the mayhem that he witnessed firsthand. He was in that house when they came. He was there, and he was the only one that got away. And he never, ever said, why did they kill my mother and father? Why did they kill my sisters and brothers? Why did they kill my nieces and nephews? Never said, why did they kill my cousins? Why did they kill all the people right in front of my eyes? He never said that as much as he said, why didn't they kill me too? And he had tremendous survivor guilt. And I'm growing up in this. So I didn't want to live in this world. And I didn't have the strength to fight this urge to eat. And I kept getting fatter and fatter and fatter. And by the time I was 10 years old, the doctor put me on amphetamines to try to curb my appetite. And when I was 10 years old, I was on 3 500-milligram pink pills of amphetamine a day. That is a lot of speed. And I'm 10, and I remember very distinctly the temples in my head would just be pounding, ba-boom, 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 ba-boom. And I would be thinking, and I'd be talking, and I'd be saying, I get accused of this now, but I'd be saying like the same thing like 200 times. And I'm in my head going, why do you keep saying that? Why do you keep saying? And I couldn't stop myself. And you sleep about, 10 minutes a month. And, and I'm not listening to anything that's going on in school because I can't hear them. The teacher sounded just like the Charlie Brown cartoons. Wah, 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 wah. I couldn't hear a thing. And now I'm an eater. I'm not a fighter. I'm getting in fist fights at school. I'm getting provoked because the wind is blowing into fights. But you don't eat. And when I don't eat, what I didn't understand was there is an untenable, horrible pain that comes about in my life as the result of not eating. And with nothing to tamp down, to quiet down those emotions, I was literally a fireball. I was literally a basket case. Excuse me. At that time, and when I was 11, some of the other stuff started coming out about these amphetamines, so they switched me from a pink pill at 500 milligrams to a blue pill at 250 milligrams for a day. So I went from 1,500 to 1,000 milligrams of amphetamine a day, and it's exactly the same result. I did everything I could as a kid to try to control this, lose weight with AIDS. You remember those candies? Some of the people that are around my age lose weight with AIDS. Go try to market that product now. No. I did TOPS, take off pounds sensibly. I don't even know if they're around anymore. I don't hear about them. TOPS, because I'm from Chicago, if you can't tell. I'm born and raised on the north side of Chicago. And I did TOPS, and I became a TOPS king. I lost like 150 pounds, 170 pounds, because it was a diet. Of course, I gained it all back. And then I was a Weight Watchers guy in my teenage years, and they brought me down to the Pick. Come on, there's plenty of seats. They brought me down to the Pick Congress Hotel downtown, and I walked that runway, and I thought I was like Miss Illinois, and they had the thing. And they had the ribbon across my chest, and here I was. And of course, I ate at Taco Bell or something on the way home, or they didn't have Taco Bell that yet, but Jack in the Box tacos, whatever it was, on the way home. And so I was off to the races again there too. No matter what I did to lose weight, my weight always sent out for reinforcements. If I lost 150, excuse me, I would gain 270. Whatever it was, I didn't look like the other kids by the time I was in high school. I didn't date. I wasn't to go on my first date with a girl until I was 35 years of age. I've been single now for 5 years again after my marriage. So, God, history's come back to repeat itself there. But I didn't go on my first date till I was 35. And I couldn't look like the other kids. And if you grew up in the 60s, you hear a lot of narishkeit. Narishkeit is a Yiddish word for foolishness about the 60s, how everybody wanted to do their own thing and be separate. Not me. I wanted to look like the other kids. I wanted to be like the other kids, and I couldn't. I couldn't wear Levi's. I couldn't wear the nice clothes. I couldn't buy my clothes at the nice store. I had to wear clothes that went out of style in the Great Depression before World War II broke out. And if it was a garment and it fit me and it covered me and we could afford it, I wore it. And there were times when I would have like 4 pairs of pants that fit, and they were all the same color and they were all the same style and they were all the same size. So it looked like I'd be wearing the same pair of pants for like years. And sometimes you look back on some of these Depression era shows or Depression era movies. I used to wear the shirts like that, and because that's the only thing we could get. And as you enter puberty, you want to look good, you want to date, you want to do those things, and I couldn't do those things. In my 20s, I was absolutely out of control. The world was whizzing by me at a very, very, very fast rate. My jealousy was manifesting. I became very jealous of my friends, as they had young parents and I had an old parent. By the time I graduated high school, my dad was 72 years old. and he was dying of cancer. And he, you know, and my mother was dying. My mother was very, very sick. And I mentioned to you, my mother's greatest ambition in life was to become an invalid and die, because my mother, I believe to this day, had a strong sense that she was mentally ill, but there was really nothing she could do about it. It would be like the wall over here trying to do something about it being a wall. She couldn't control it. She couldn't cure it, and she didn't choose it. And so when I was 22 years old, after long destructive illness, my mother finally passed away. And I was dealing with things as a kid that I was not prepared to deal with. I was dealing with them getting sick. I was dealing with them getting old. I was dealing with them fighting with each other. I was taking them to doctors. I was paying for medicine out of the money that I made. I was doing things that I should not have had to really worry about. But when I say I should not, that's my script talking. But the script that life gave me, the script that God gave me, demanded that I do those things. So when I say should, that's subjective, because that's what I wanted for myself. I wanted young, rich, American, wonderful parents. My father spoke very little English, and he spoke English only when he had to. He didn't like speaking it. He wasn't comfortable speaking it, and he only spoke it when he had to. When I was 22, my mom died. And before she died, we were about 1,100 pounds between three adults. My mother was about 275, my father was about 275, and I was well over 500 pounds at the time that they died. So we were about 1,100 pounds or so between three adults. My father died in 1978. And when he passed away, I was left with a mountain of problems. I had absolutely no one to turn to. I do not have brothers and sisters, aunts, uncles, cousins. I do not have nieces and nephews. I do not. Every morning, I wake up at my own family reunion. And so I absolutely don't have them. My father came from a very large family, but they were killed. So I never met them, and they never met me. But the bottom line is that money became an issue. And now I'm 24 years old, and I'm writing bad checks to anyone dumb enough to take them. I'm lying when the truth would have served me better. And my world is spinning into a world of fear. And my world is spinning into a world of food. And my food habit at that time was about not my hooker habit, not my cocaine habit, not my heroin habit. My food habit was about $100 to $150 a day every day, and my income is nowhere near that. Now, I want to back up for just a minute, and I want to tell you about the absolute benevolence of my God, the absolute love that my God has for me, because this is a very important part of my story. And I'm truncating my story because we've got a lot of ground to cover this morning, and we've got a lot of ground to cover this afternoon, and I want to make sure I cover it. The last coherent conversation that I had with my mother took place about 2 weeks before she died, maybe a week before she died, and then she went into a coma, and she came out of it very briefly, but this was the last coherent conversation I had with my mom, and it took place in a hospital, Evanston Hospital in suburban Chicago. My mother was up when I got there, and she asked me to please find a way to stop eating. And she was crying. At the end of my mother's life, she was an amputee from diabetes. By the end of her life, she was on dialysis. And let me tell you something about dialysis in 1976. It was ugly. The shunts would get infected. It was just an ugly, ugly situation. And she said to me, "My son, please find a way to stop eating. You have your whole life in front of you, but you're going to waste it if you continue eating like that." She said, "I had such high hopes for you when you were born, and the food just came and just killed you. It just knocked you down." And I left her room, and she died not long after that, as I mentioned. My father died in November of that year. And in November of that year, when he died, just about 5 or 6 hours before he died, we had a very nice conversation, and he was also crying. And I was sitting at his bedside, and he was touching my face. I can feel him doing it now. And he said to me, Maizun. Maizun means my son. Zasin is all of the Balakovskis. The Balakovskis were the people in charge of rounding you up so you could be killed more efficiently. And he'd say the fressen. Now, in Yiddish, essen means to eat normally. Fressen means to eat like a glutton. Fressen means to eat compulsively. And he'd say that the overeating, in English I'm translating, came and took you away from us. And he said it was a mirdelech hazach in deine leben. A mirdelech hazach means it was a murderous thing in your life, this the way you're eating. And he said to me, Maizun, find a way not to eat like that. Find a way so you can live and not eat like that. And he said, I had such dreams, such high hopes for you. He'd say to me, he touched my face and he said, I thought maybe one day you'd be the president of the United States, but you kept eating or something like that. My father was very touched by being an American. And the one thing that he could bequeath me was that I was born in this country. And he never felt safe during his life. He always felt like they were going to come and kill us for sure. But he believed that because I was an American, that was the greatest thing that you could be. And when I would find him crying, and if you've never seen your dad cry, I've seen my dad cry thousands of times. He would cry because he would hear the sounds. He would cry because he saw the sights. He saw them shooting his sister, who had 2 children under the age of 5, and her mouth ripped from her head. And he saw that, and the sound of it, and the sight of it, and the screaming of it haunted him his entire life. No one 14 years old, which is what he was at that time, should have to endure that. But he believed that because I was an American, that he had completed the purpose of his life. And he begged me to find a way not to eat so much. Now, the reason that I tell you that isn't to shock you, and the reason I tell you that isn't so that you'll feel bad for a man that you will never meet because he's dead, or to feel bad for me. The reason I tell you that is because a God who is so powerful took that and made it into something good as only God can. Because my father died on November the 11th, 1978, and I miss him terribly. But as lo and behold, in late January, I was approached by 2 people who pushed their way past the filth in my apartment, past the pizza boxes in my apartment, past the potato chip bags in my apartment, and they said some things to me about a meeting of Overeaters Anonymous. And on February the 2nd, 1979, I attended a meeting of Overeaters Anonymous in Skokie, Illinois, at the Orchard Mental Health Center on Grosse Pointe Road. Now, God likes to laugh, too. Here I am, crazy as a loon, 500-600 pounds if I'm an ounce, and I'm attending a meeting at the Orchard Mental Health Center. Come on, God likes to laugh, too. Now, when I walked into my first meeting of OA, I saw a room full of people that looked very similar to what I see here tonight, today. I saw people that looked to me like they were normal. I saw people that looked to me like they didn't need to be here. Now, some of you may have an idea in your head that in your history, you came in and you thought to yourself that the people were crazy, but you were well. I had the opposite effect. I looked around and I saw, wait a minute, I could put any 4 of you in my pocket. What the hell are you people doing here? And I knew I was crazy, but I couldn't understand what you were doing here. And little by little, I started going to meetings. And then I graduated OA a couple of years later after losing some weight and after finding a little bit of what you were saying sinking into my insane head. And I left OA, and I had a beautiful graduation ceremony, very similar to some of the graduation ceremonies some of you have had. Welcome to McDonald's. Can I take your order, please? Okay. And that's usually what you'll hear at any graduation from OA. Okay? And I came back again a few years later, and I heard some things, and I saw some things, and I started to understand some things that changed my life forever. And one of the reasons that I came out here today from Scottsdale is to talk about those very things so that maybe in some way you can be helped by them too. One of the things that I saw was on page 58 of the big book, and it said, if you want what we have and you are willing to go to any length to get there, then you are ready to take certain steps. And it was pointed out to me by a very, very wise man, very wonderful man in Chicago, that in his opinion, this is the essence of step zero. If you want what we have, what is it we have? Why are you here? And I said, because you guys aren't eating. And he said, wrong. See, you go to Weight Watchers, they're not eating there either. He said, you go to a room full of normies, they're not eating there either. He said, what is it we seem to have? And I didn't know, and he told me. He says, there are people in that room, and he pointed inside at the Lincoln Park Alano Club in Chicago. And he pointed inside, and he said, there are people in that room, and they are not eating compulsively, and they are doing so happily. That they are not fighting food. That they are not sitting there stark, raving, abstinent. That this is not what they're doing. They're not hanging from the chandelier, abstinent. And we're going to talk this morning about the vast world of difference between dieting with group support and real recovery. And that's going to be one of the themes of what we're going to be talking about today and tomorrow. That there is a world of difference between dieting with group support and recovery. And then he said to me, and he showed me, are you willing to go to any length to get it? Then you're ready to then you're ready to take certain steps. And he told me something that you're going to hear me say. This is not a program for people who need it. This is not a program for people who want it. This is a program for people who do it. This is an action program. There's no chapter into thinking. There's no chapter into wishing or hoping. And there's no chapter into sitting in meetings and hoping to get this by osmosis. There is nothing said in that meeting that is going to come up through your rear end and strike you recovered. You're going to have to do the program, not sit in meetings. We hear this all the time. Keep coming back. Keep coming back. And I'm not saying you shouldn't come back. And I'm glad you're here this morning because I'd hate to be doing this in an empty room. But when we say that to people, keep coming back, let's not get confused between keep coming back and not doing the work. There's more to this than getting your butt to the Tuesday night meeting at the church. There's more to this than sitting in meetings and being the treasurer or the literature person. There's more to this. And we're going to be talking about that too. And then I looked at with him at the thesis line of the big book, and that's where I went, gulp. Because the thesis line in the big book is on page 45, and it says, the main object of this book is to help you find a power greater than yourself, which will solve your problem. And boy, that's where I got in trouble, because this God thing was going to rear its ugly head. And one of the things we're going to be talking about today is that 2 and 10 are the most underutilized steps. If 3 and 4 are the most misunderstood steps, then 2 and 10 are the most underutilized steps. And where you see people struggling in 4, struggling in 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, and 12, they are really struggling with 2 because they have dragged a concept of God into their program that didn't work for them as children, and it's not going to work for them now, but they will not change a thing. And we're going to talk about choosing your own concept of God when we get to Bill's story a little later on this morning. we're going to be talking about creating a God that you are willing to believe in. There's nothing in the book that says you must believe, that says you must be willing to believe. And if you have a God in your head that's going to kick your ass, or you have a God in your head that finds you short of account, if you have a God in your head that you don't quite believe in or are willing to believe in, then we're going to look this morning at changing the description of that God. And we're not going to talk about changing your religion. That's none of my business. We're going to talk about what kind of God do you have in your head that's preventing you from doing this work. And let's now adapt a God that will welcome you into His kingdom, into His life, and will welcome you with an outstretched hand so that you can recover too. We're going to be talking about that when we get to Bill's story. And then I saw something on page XX in the foreword to the second edition. In the foreword to the second edition on page XX, it says, of 100 people that came into Alcoholics Anonymous, 50 of them got sober at once. Of the remaining 50, 25 came back and got sober, and of the other 25, they showed marked improvement. Now, that is a 75% recovery rate. Now, I have done retreats for Overeaters Anonymous in most of the states in this union. I have been in meetings as far southeast as Boca Raton, Florida. I have done big book retreats in Lancaster, Pennsylvania, Boston, Massachusetts. I've done them as far southwest as San Diego, California. And I've done them as far north as Wasilla, Anchorage, Alaska. I've done in Mobile, Alabama, and you name it, I've probably been there. Most of the states in this union have been invaded by me and my big book. And I was born and raised in Chicago, and I live in Scottsdale, Arizona now. I can't talk about 75% in any of the places I've seen. We can't talk about 50% recovery. We can't talk about 20% recovery. We can't talk about 5% recovery in Overeaters Anonymous. We can't talk about much beyond 1.5%, 2% of recovery. And why? What is the difference? Is we keep getting distracted from the big book of AA. And we keep watering the program down. And we keep getting distracted by other literature, by tools, by dieting, where so many of the groups today are welded to the first half of the first step. They're fabricated right to the first half of the first step, and they won't leave it. And it's about the food, the food, the food, the food, the food, the food. Yeah, it's something about the food, but we're going to talk this morning in the doctor's opinion that we are going to see that for the compulsive overeater, food is not the problem. That food is the answer to the problem, and we're not addressing the problem. The problem is the untenable, unbelievable, searing, constant, unrelenting pain that comes about in the life of a compulsive overeater when we're not eating. And only a spiritual awakening as a result of the steps is going to quiet that pain down. And we have forgotten the rest of the steps. In so many of the meetings, and I, you know, people call me from the offshoot groups, you know, they got this group and that group, and all the groups, it's the same leopard with the same spots, but they call it by a different name. They're welded to the first half of the first step. There's a group not far from here. They only eat in one restaurant, one chain of restaurants. That's it. I told them, you better not come to Arizona, because we don't have them. If their job transferred them to Arizona, they might as well forget it, because we don't have it. We don't have those restaurants in Arizona. So I'm going to wind up my part of the story by saying this. It's been a great journey. And you know, you get asked all the time about if I could take a pill and recover, I wouldn't give you.
I wouldn't cheat you out of a minute of it. What a ride. Wow, what a ride. Woo, it's been a hoot. I was 700 pounds at one time. I had a size 80 waist. I couldn't function as a human being. I was emasculated by this illness. In every mental and physical way, a man can be emasculated. I didn't wear underwear. I had towels between layers of flab to keep the skin from rubbing together. I couldn't get in a car. I couldn't get out of a car. I couldn't function. I had the cleanest steering wheel in Illinois because the steering wheel was to rub against the bottom of my stomach. I had black lines on my pants where the steering wheel used to rub. No, you're right. It's not safe to drive that way. And I couldn't function at all. I couldn't go to the movies because I couldn't fit in the seat. And I couldn't go to a game because I couldn't fit in the seat. And I couldn't go on an airplane because I couldn't fit in the seat. And I couldn't go on a date because I didn't fit into the world. And how many 600-700-pound guys do most girls lust after?
None.
And the bottom line is that's not life. That's existing. And I wouldn't wish that on anybody. I wouldn't wish that on anybody. People used to laugh at me. People used to point at me in shopping centers. Children used to laugh at me. People would walk up to me and slap my stomach. People that I didn't even know would walk up to me and say, "Do you know how fat you are?" "No, I really don't. Tell me." I couldn't walk. I looked like Two Gun Sam because this is about as far down as my arms would go. This is about as far down. I couldn't move my arms to my side. I couldn't do any of those things. If I wore socks, the swelling in my lower legs was so profuse, the edema, that the socks would dig into me. I had fissures on the bottom of my feet. Fissures are cracks in the skin that come about as the result of morbid obesity. I was living death. I was walking death. And unlike some of the other addictions, or all the other addictions, I had a years-long path to any semblance of physical normality. I'm going to say something that might shock you. I lost 200 pounds in this program, and I was still a 500-pound guy. I lost 300 pounds in this program, and I was a 400-pound guy. I lost hundreds and hundreds of pounds before a woman that I worked with finally said to me, "It looks like you're losing weight." That's not living, and I wouldn't wish that on any of you. But as I just got through telling you, I wouldn't give you the pill because here's the other part that I don't normally get to talk about. This is the greatest way of life there is in the world. This is the most fantastic journey. Begin it. If you're sitting here this morning and you're fighting food and you're still dieting with group support and you don't have a sponsor that is walking you through the big book like we're going to do, then I invite you to stick around today and let's do this together to get you started. I invite you to begin that journey in your life and see where that will take you. Trust God. Test God. See where you can find Him wanting. You will not find a weakness in His armor. You will find yourself catapulted into situations you could never expect. And I've lost a little over 500 pounds since the very beginning. And I'm alive today because of this book, because of these steps, and because of a wonderful way of life that I found here in Overeaters Anonymous. Now let's begin, if we can, with the doctor's opinion. Normally I'd give you a break now, but my kidneys are saying, let's keep going. And the clock is saying, let's keep going. So if you could, turn to the doctor's opinion. I'll give you a second to do that. For centuries now, prior to this opinion being discovered, for centuries, and I don't have a podium to put my book on, which is a little bit of a problem. Where's Jeff? He's not here. Okay, God, what should we do? Okay, I'm going to sit down for this part because I need something to put my book on, and when I get a chance, can you all see me if I do that? All right. There was supposed to be a bar stool in here. I was actually going to do a couple of Frank Sinatra numbers. No, I'm just kidding. All right. For centuries, people wondered about gluttony and alcoholism. As far back 6,000 years ago, Solomon, the king of Israel, he philosophized in the Book of Solomon about alcoholism being an illness, alcoholism being a disease, but he had no cure for it, and he couldn't prove it. In the 1640s, there was a doctor who lived in England, and his name was Dr. Trotter. And Dr. Trotter, he lived in England, and he believed that alcoholism was indeed an illness, but he couldn't prove it, and he had no cure for it. One of the people who signed the Declaration of Independence, a man who became the nation's first Surgeon General, Dr. Benjamin Rush, in 1790, he wrote a paper in which he believed that alcoholism was an illness, but he couldn't prove it, and he had no cure for it. I opened my book right to the doctor's opinion. That's why I'm thanking God, because I couldn't find the page and talk at the same time. That's how feeble-minded I am these days. But anyway, he wrote a paper in which he believed that alcoholism was an illness, but he couldn't prove it, and he had no cure for it. Now, if you ever come to Chicago, which is where I'm from, and you're a tourist in Chicago, undoubtedly some of the places you'll want to go to eat, to listen to music, to dine, whatever it is, will be on Rush Street, so named for him. That's who that's named for. Are there any Chicagoans in the room, by the way? Anybody here from Chicago? Nope. You're from Naperville. Where in Chicago?
Near north.
Near north, but in the city?
Yeah.
You're in. What else? Who else? Yeah. Rogers Park, me too. I went to Mather. Okay, all right. East Rogers Park or west? East. Okay, you're still okay. You're still okay. All right, I'm a West Rogers Park boy. I went to Mather High School. Okay, the doctor's opinion was written at the behest of Bill Wilson by a doctor who treated him. And this is a doctor that has a story, so it should be told here. Spilkes in Yiddish is ants in your pants. In the 1920s, Dr. William Duncan Silkworth was a neurologist. He had had a brief period of time in medical school treating alcoholics, but it wasn't really of an interest to him. And he was a neurologist, and on October the 29th, 1929, which is a date, Black Tuesday, which we're going to talk about in Bill's story more, he lost everything he had in the stock market. And he was in need of, if there's one guy I can always count on, it's my sponsor, John. Yes. Okay, no problem. Thank
you. I'm going to see if I get in your podium, but you may have to just leave it on your side.
You are colossal.
Okay.
All right. This poor man takes very good care of me. Thank you. He lost everything he had when the stock market crashed in 1929 on the 29th of October. And one of his very good friends, you got to love this guy, was Charlie Towns of the Towns Hospital. Now, the Towns Hospital at this time was the preeminent hospital for the treatment of drug addiction and alcoholism in the world. It was on, in New York City on Park Avenue. And Charlie Towns owned the Towns Hospital, and he knew Silkworth and he liked Silkworth. So he gave Silkworth a job for $35 a week working at the Towns Hospital treating the alcoholics. And from November of 1929 through meeting Bill in 1933, He formulated an opinion based on what was in front of him that he saw. He saw people coming in for drug addiction treatment, for alcoholism treatment, and they would come in deplorable situations, deplorable shape. And they would load them up with B12, and they would feed them, and they would rest them up, and they would get them going again, and they would leave. But there was a group of these people, primarily men, so let's stick with men. There were some women, but primarily they were men, that came into the hospital in horrible shape, left, and came back, and left, and came back, and left, and came back. Sometimes that day, sometimes in a week, sometimes in a month, but they came back. And on observation of these men, he formulated an opinion. And the opinion that he had was so controversial for its time that when Bill Wilson approached him in 1937 to write his opinion, he only would do it under the condition of anonymity because he didn't want to be thrown out of the medical profession. And he said to Bill, I will write this for you, but don't you dare put my name in there, because if you do, they're going to throw me out of the medical profession. So for the first 10 printings of the book, between 1939, when it was published originally, and 1949, when we go into the 11th printing, you have blank, blank, MD. But in the 11th printing until now, if you look in your book, it'll say William Silkworth, MD. And Dr. Silkworth said to Bill Wilson after Harry Thibault in 1949 published a paper where the American Medical Association, the American Psychiatric Association, accepted alcoholism as an illness, and he said to Bill Wilson, okay, you can put my name in there now. But until then, he wouldn't allow it. So what we're going to cover this morning was, in its time, extremely controversial. Let's go to page 25 in the fourth edition, Roman numerals. That's XXV. Okay. We of Alcoholics Anonymous. By the way, I want to throw this in there, too. Thank you, Jeff. Dr. Silkworth was only able to enjoy his name being in there for a very short period of time because, as I told you, in 1949 he allowed it, but in 1951 he passed away. Thank you so much. Right here is fine. Good. Thank you so much. And if you've ever watched Lucy and Desi, I can do a little... Okay. Remember the drum that they used to play? Okay. If you don't know who Lucy and Desi are, Google them. Sorry. Lucy and Desi. Remember he used to play, the guy in the band in the Copacabana or something used to play the drum? What? Tropicana, yeah. Yeah, that was the club he owned, yeah. Okay. We of Alcoholics Anonymous believe that the reader will be interested in the medical estimate of the plan of recovery described in this book. Convincing testimony must surely come from medical men who have had experience with the sufferings of our members and have witnessed our return to health. A well-known doctor, chief physician at a nationally prominent hospital specializing in alcoholic and drug addiction, gave Alcoholics Anonymous this letter, to whom it may concern. I have specialized in the treatment of alcoholism for many years. In late 1934, I attended a patient, who, though he had been a competent businessman of good earning capacity, was an alcoholic of a type I had come to regard as hopeless. And when he says this word hopeless, I hope what you will take that to mean in your life is that hopeless does not have to have a negative connotation. Hopeless can mean I am out of ideas. And one of my mentors in this program, Tom W. in Chicago, who's gone to that great meeting in the sky now, he used to say to me, are you out of ideas yet, kid? Are you out of ideas yet, kid? And he'd say that to me all the time. Are you out of ideas? I'm asking you. You don't have to answer out loud. Because if you're not out of ideas on how you're going to do this yourself, your way, then we cannot help you. You have to be devoid of ideas on how you're going to do this your way. in the course of his third treatment, now we're going to learn in the next chapter in Bill's story that Bill is going to recount three hospitalizations in the town's hospital with Dr. Silkworth. He acquired certain ideas concerning a possible means of recovery. As part of his rehabilitation, he commenced to present his conceptions to other alcoholics, impressing upon them that they must do likewise with still others. This has become the basis of a rapidly growing fellowship of these men and their families. This man and over 100 others appear to have recovered. Now, we hear this all the time, recovered, recovered. Can you recover? I'm a recovered compulsive overeater in that I do not sit and obsess about food. I have had a spiritual awakening as the result of the steps. If I stop doing the steps, I'll be eating Kit Kat bars and Oreo cookies faster than you can say Bob's your uncle. Because the recovery is not a cure. There's a vast difference between recovery and cure. I personally know scores of cases who were of the type with whom other methods had failed completely. Now, I'm going to make an assumption that if the diets you went on had worked, you wouldn't be sitting in the Big Book study this morning here at the OA birthday in 2015 on January the 24th, would you? You would be just living your life. Maybe you'd be watching the Saturday morning cartoons, but you'd be eating safely out there, and you wouldn't be in this meeting. So if everything you've done and everything you've thought and everything you've tried has failed, then again, I urge you, take my hand, take our hands of the people here that are our sponsors, and there are many, and work this program and join us on that broad highway. Sorry. These facts appear to be of extreme medical importance because of the extraordinary possibility, rapid growth inherent in this group. They may mark a new epoch in the annals of alcoholism. These men may well have a remedy for thousands of such situations. You may rely absolutely on anything they say about themselves. Very truly yours, William D. Silkworth, M.D., and there's his name. The physician who at our request gave us this letter has been kind enough to enlarge upon his views in another statement which follows. In this statement, he confirms what we who have suffered alcoholic torture must believe. Now, one of the booby mindses, what's a booby mindsa? It's a Yiddish word. Booby means grandmother, mindsa means story. Stories your grandmother would tell you? I never had a grandmother, but what I can tell you is it's another name for BS. And it's another name for BS because you'll sit in here, well, you can just do it your way, or you could do it Lynn's way, or Mike's way, or Fred's way. No, there's one way. There's no chapter in here that says this is one of the solutions. There's a chapter in here that says there is a solution. There is a chapter, a one solution, and that's the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. That the body of the alcoholic is quite as abnormal as his mind. Now, this is the first inference in recorded history of the physical component to this illness, and we're going to come back to that in just a minute, but this is the very beginning salvo in a very controversial thing, because up to this point, gluttony, which is, if you look up in any good dictionary, is what we are, gluttony, alcoholism, drug addiction, whatever it is, takes its tap root in stupidity, weak-willed, lack of willpower, lack of intelligence, laziness. Isn't that what you've heard your whole life? If you have been a childhood compulsive overeater, isn't that what people told you? You lack willpower. You should just push yourself away from the table, right? So now we're seeing that there's another component to it, and that is a physical component to this illness, and that is very controversial in its time. It did not satisfy us to be told that we could not control our drinking just because we were maladjusted to life, that we were in full flight from reality or were outright mental defectives. These things were true to some extent, in fact, to a considerable extent with some of us, but we are sure that our bodies were sickened as well. In our belief, any picture of the alcoholic which leaves out this physical factor is incomplete. The doctor's theory that we have an allergy, there's a word that we're going to come back to, make mental note of it, allergy, because we are going to talk about that in just a minute here. Allergy, sorry, Okay, sorry. As lame, to alcohol interests us. As laymen, our opinion as to its soundness may, of course, mean little. But as ex-problem drinkers, we can say his explanation makes good sense. It explains many things for which we cannot otherwise account. And what they're talking about there, very specifically, when he talks about the things for which we cannot otherwise account, are all the tens of thousands of times that you have gone into a situation and you've convinced yourself that this time you're going to eat one piece of pizza, that this time you're going to eat three Oreo cookies, that this time you're going to only eat one whatever it is, and you end up eating way, way more than you ever first imagined. This is what he is specifically talking about, because the food goes into the mouth because of the buildup of emotions, which triggers out the mental twist. But the food continues to go into the mouth and continues to go into the mouth because of this physical factor, which is the allergy, which is in my life from the time I was a little child. The more I eat, the more I want. The more I want, the more I eat. The more I eat, the more I want. And it's just endless. The only time in my life I ate one cookie was when it was the last cookie that I could possibly get my hands on. That is the only time in my life I ate one cookie. Trust me on that one. Though we work out our solutions, bottom of XXVI, which is 26 in Roman numerals, though we work out our solution on the spiritual as well as an altruistic plane, we favor hospitalization for the alcoholic who is very jittery or befogged. More often than not, it is imperative that a man's brain be cleared before he is approached, as he then has a better chance of understanding and accepting what we have to offer. Now, before we continue, I want to make this very clear what he is saying here. Put down the food. Put down the food. If you're still eating, there's nothing we can really do for you because you're not going to have a spiritual awakening as a result of anything up to and including an anvil to your head while you're eating Kit Kat bars and Suzy Q's and cupcakes and all the other stuff. A Kit Kat bar makes me drunk. And a Kit Kat bar alters my perception of reality. When I eat a Kit Kat bar, I'm not really there. It looks like I'm there, kind of looks like I'm there, but when I eat a Kit Kat bar, I am off into the ionosphere. And in no way, shape, or form am I going to have a spiritual awakening as the result of anything. And so I must put down the food. And that is very important. And you don't have to put it down for a year. You don't have to put it down for 2 years. Put it down for a couple of days. Is it going to be really hard? And am I going to get a question when we do Q&A? Well, if I'm powerless, how can I put down the food? You can put it down for a couple of days, and with a good sponsor, you will begin to work through the steps, and you will no longer want the food. That is the miracle of what we offer here. But you are going to have to gut it out for a couple of days. I wish I had something else to tell you. If you've never been to an AA meeting, try one. Ask those guys in AA, say, by the way, Sam, will you work with somebody who's still drunk? Of course not. Of course not. Continuing here, page XXVII or 27 in Roman numerals. The subject presented in this book seems to me to be of paramount importance to those afflicted with alcoholic addiction. I say this after many years' experience as medical director of one of the oldest hospitals in the country treating alcoholic and drug addiction. There was therefore a sense of real satisfaction when I was asked to contribute a few words on a subject which is covered in such masterly detail in these pages. Now, the next paragraph we're going to cover twice. We doctors have realized for a long time that some form of moral psychology was of urgent importance to alcoholics, but its application presented difficulties beyond our conception. What with our ultra-modern standards, our scientific approach to everything, we are perhaps not well equipped to apply the powers of good that lie outside our synthetic knowledge. What is he saying to you there? Let's look at it again. and let's take a look at it with some different words, remembering that Silkworth is a doctor. He's not a member of AA. He's not an alcoholic. He's not a member of the Oxford Group movement. He's not a member of any of those things. He is a scientist. He is a doctor. He is a man of science. So let's take a look at what he's saying. We doctors have realized for a long time that some form of spiritual awakening was of urgent importance to alcoholics, but its application presented difficulties beyond medicine's conception. What with medicine's ultra-modern standards, medicine's scientific approach to everything, doctors are perhaps not well equipped to apply the powers of God that lie outside our medical knowledge. What is he telling you there? We know what's wrong with you, and there isn't a freaking thing in this world we can do for you. Not a thing that we can do for you. We wish we could help you. We can operate on you. We can load you up with amphetamines. We can counsel you. We can do these things for you. But when it comes to this, there is nothing we can do. And they feel as bad about it as we do. But there is truly nothing that can be done for the compulsive overeater by medicine. Only a spiritual awakening will help me. Only. Many years ago, one of the leading contributors to this book came under our care in this hospital, and while here, he acquired certain ideas which he put into practical application at once. This is Bill Wilson, and he came into contact with the Oxford Group movement between his hospitalization number 2 and hospitalization number 3 that we're going to talk about in the next chapter. Later, he requested the privilege of being allowed to tell his story to other patients here, and with some misgiving, we consented. The cases we have followed through have been most interesting. In fact, many of them are amazing. The unselfishness of these men, as we have come to know them, the entire absence of profit motive, and their community spirit is indeed inspiring to one who has labored long and wearily in this alcoholic field. They believe in themselves and still more in the power. Now, notice power is capitalized. Power, which pulls chronic alcoholics back from the gates of death, and the power that he's talking about is, of course, God. Of course, an alcoholic ought to be freed from his physical craving for liquor. What is he telling you there? Put down the food. And this often requires a definite hospital procedure before psychological measures, spiritual awakening, can be of maximum benefit. We believe... Come on in, there's plenty of chairs. We believe, and so suggested a few years ago, that the action of alcohol on these chronic alcoholics is a manifestation of an allergy. There's that word allergy again. And let's take a look at this word allergy, because I promised you we would come back to it, and we're gonna right now. That word allergy baffled me when I came into program. People would say to me, don't eat Kit Kat bars, you're allergic to them. Don't eat pizza, you're allergic to them. And I'd say, what are you talking about? I eat Kit Kat bars all the time. I don't break out in hives. I don't have a rash. I don't have any of that stuff. I'm allergic to cantaloupe, pineapple, and honeydew melon. And when I eat those things, I get canker sores on my tongue. And they're very annoying. And I have to go to the drugstore and get a chemical to put on there and put ice on it so that those canker sores will go down. But I never had those kind of reactions when I ate chocolate or when I ate pizza, and I didn't understand this word allergy to save my life. And then I did something with my sponsor that has never let me down. I went to a source that had the information, and it's called the dictionary. And long before we had cell phones and computers, we had things called the dictionary. And I looked up this word allergy. And like many words, there's several different definitions. And one of the definitions of this word allergy is an adverse, abnormal reaction to a food, beverage, or substance. Adverse means it's harmful. Abnormal means that my reaction is outside the norm of what most people will react. Now, can I relate to this word allergy? You bet I can. Because every time I ate a Kit Kat bar, or every time I ate pizza or ice cream, I would eat more. And the more I ate, the more I wanted. The more I wanted, the more I ate. The more I ate, the more I wanted. Cue the chipmunks, because that's where we're going, but I can't talk that fast. But that's that allergy. So what he's telling me here is that my reaction to the food, once it's inside of me, once it's inside of me, is both adverse and abnormal. Now can I relate to this word allergy? You bet I can. You bet I can. Now Silkworth and I are ready to do business because now I'm absolutely on his wavelength. Yes, I am. Okay, let's go. Let's continue. Excuse me. That the phenomenon of craving is limited to this class and never occurs in the average temperate drinker. These allergic types can never safely use alcohol in any form at all. And once having formed the habit and found they cannot break it, once having lost their self-confidence, their reliance upon things human, their problems pile up on them and become astonishingly difficult to solve. Of course I lost confidence in myself. Every test I took was a zero. Every grade I got was an F. Everything I tried with all my heart, with all my might, I saw the world right there. It was right in front of me. I saw the girls and the money and the jobs and the colleges, and I saw the wonderful things that life had to offer, but I couldn't breach the gap. I couldn't breach the gap, and so not suddenly, over time, I lost complete confidence in my ability to do anything. And of course I lost confidence. Everything I tried failed. And it says their problems pile up on them and become astonishingly difficult to solve. I only have a brain, and mine's feeble at best. But when you fill my brain with eating and not eating and being fat and wanting to be thin while I'm fat and all this other stuff, I don't have any brain power left to solve 2 and 2 is 4. Is it? Right? 2 and 2? Right. Okay, good. I don't have the brain power to solve any problems at all whatsoever. So of course my problems piled up on me because I pushed everything off. I never did what was in front of me. I spent my whole life trying to avoid things like homework and avoid things like responsibility, and it only made things worse. I spent my whole life trying to just catch up to where I would have been had I just done the task in the first place. And what was I doing? Eating or stealing or lying to try to get the money to buy the food? Of course. Can I relate to Silkworth now? You bet I can. Frothy emotional appeal seldom suffices. The message which can interest and hold these people must have depth and weight. In nearly all cases, their ideals must be grounded in a power greater than themselves if they are to recreate their lives. And this is why I'm going to charge each one of you an admission fee to my big book study here this morning. I didn't come out here from Scottsdale, Arizona for free. I came out here and you're going to pick up the check. And here's the check you're going to pick up. You're going to take it upon yourself to understand that you speak that language of the heart that he's talking about. That you have the depth and the weight to communicate to the next compulsive overeater who's dying in their illness. You have that ability to try. If they want to be recovered, you can help them as no one else can. That you have that charge by me today, I hope you will not waste it. You have that ability because you've lived the life of a compulsive overeater. And if you have this illness and you are in recovery, not if you're not in recovery, if you're in recovery and you've had a spiritual awakening as the result of the steps, you can carry a life-giving message that no one else can carry. And there are people out there suffering by the millions. And there are people in this room and in these rooms that are dying. And we as an organization, and I know some of you are going to go out there, and did you hear what he said? And this is part of what's going to come back to me. We as in Overeaters Anonymous are spending much money much manpower, women power, to attract people into our fellowship, as well we should. However, there are people that are sitting right next to you that are dying of their untreated addiction, and we are saying nothing to them. We are not addressing it at all, because we don't want to ruffle any feathers. And I'd rather hurt your feelings than scramble to get to your funeral. This is a life and death situation. This is a life and death situation. And every one of you is charged. I didn't come here from Scottsdale just to stand up here and yak at you. You have a responsibility too. It says in the Old Testament, you save one life and you save the world. Save one life and you save the world. And every one of you that are in here because somebody brought the message to you. Pass it. Recover. Have a spiritual awakening. If you haven't had a spiritual awakening, you're not ready yet. But if you've had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps in this book, go carry that message. Don't dump it on me. Some of you are going to call me and say, can you talk to my brother? Can you talk to my aunt? Can you talk to my neighbor? Why don't you talk to them? Why don't you show them what this does for you? Why don't you show them your recovery? Because you showing them will do a lot more than me telling them. Show them. Do your own 12-step work. Don't pawn it off on me. I get enough. You do yours too. If any feel that a psychiatrist, page 28, Roman numerals, XXVIII, 28. If any feel that a psychiatrist directing a hospital for alcoholics, we appear somewhat sentimental. Let them stand with us a while on the firing line. See the tragedies, the despairing wives, the little children. Let the solving of these problems become a part of their daily work and even of their sleeping moments. And the most cynical will not wonder that we have accepted and encouraged this movement. We feel after many years of experience that we have found nothing which has contributed more to the rehabilitation of these men than the altruistic movement now growing up among them. And this altruism, one helping the other, is something we're going to be talking about in Bill's story, because we're going to be talking about where this comes from, and it comes from the Oxford Group movement. The progenitor of OA is AA, and the progenitor, the ancestor of AA, is the Oxford Group movement, which was not concerned with alcoholism, but this altruism comes from Frank Buckman, who founded the Oxford Group, going on a mission to China and seeing people who were very enthusiastic about their Christianity. Enthusiasm, there's a word, entheos from the Greek. Entheos, entheos means from God. And one helping the other. One helping the other. Somebody calls me up and they're miserable. Somebody calls me up and they're not happy. The first question out of my mouth is going to be, what have you done today to help somebody else? What have you done today to give to somebody else? What have you done to bring this message to someone else? It's not a program for people who need it. It's not a program for people who want it. It's a program for people who do it. Now, before we read the next paragraph, let's dispel a myth. And some of you have believed this myth your whole life, and we're going to smash it. And the myth is that food is the problem. No, it's not. Food is not the problem. There are people in OA that are non-compulsive overeaters. Maybe for people who eat compulsively, food might be the problem. But if you are a compulsive overeater, food is not the problem. Now, you may be sitting in the chair going, wait a minute, compulsively overeating, compulsive overeater, they sound very similar. They're worlds apart. Worlds apart. They're so different. One is Pluto and one is the sun. Well, Pluto's decommissioned. So Neptune and the sun. Okay. To a person who eats compulsively, food is the problem. They gain a little weight. We're going to talk about that on the next page. They gain a little weight and they cut down on their food and they're fine. Right? if you are a compulsive overeater like me, food is not the problem. And I see some of you looking at me like, what the hell is he talking about? I'll explain it. All human beings have emotions. All human beings have happiness, sadness, elation, depression. I'm not talking about clinical. I'm talking about sad. All human beings have fear, anger. All human beings have disappointment, jealousy, selfishness. All human beings have these emotions. Every one of us has them. They're imbued into us by God. Now, in a normal human being, these emotions dispel out of them by having a drink, by going to the gym, by walking the dog, by hitting their desk, whatever it is, saying some golf words. They dispel these emotions because they have a natural release valve. Some of you know normal people. Their emotions do not build to the level which, unfortunately, in us will wake up the mind, wake up the mental twist, and the mental twist says, what? Hey, we're unhappy down here. Mental twist says, I know what to do about that. I'm going to send you into a chunky bar. And the intelligence says, I'm not eating that chunky bar. I want to lose weight. And the emotions demand that you eat a chunky bar. And the intelligence says, no way. I'm not opening wide for chunky. I'm not doing that. Some of you don't remember the commercials from the 60s. Open wide for chunky. You gotta stay with me on some. I gotta have a little fun up here too. Come on.
I remember it.
Oh, good. Okay. I'm not alone.
I never liked chunky.
Oh, what are you doing here? What on earth are you doing here? Okay. I'm just checking. I mean, you don't like chunky bars. What the hell? Hey, all right. What are you doing here? Okay. All right. Anytime. Now, this is the important part. This is the part you should pay attention to because this isn't Narishkeit. Anytime the emotional meets the intelligent, the emotional will win. Every time the emotional meets the intelligence, the emotional will win. And so you will eat the chunky bar. You will eat the ice cream because the mental twist demands it of you. Because if food is not the problem, what is the problem? The problem is the undeniable, untenable, unrelenting pain that comes about in the life of a compulsive overeater when we are not eating. And the only thing that your brain knows to do, your mental twist knows to do, to put out the fire, is to send you reeling to 7-Eleven, to send you reeling into Quick Trip, to send you reeling into the grocery store, so you can put out the fire. And as much hell as the food has caused you, as much pain and torture as the food has caused you, as much embarrassment and shame, and it has amputated you from life, and you can no longer walk, and you can no longer function, and you look like shit, and you feel like shit. And as long as you have those feelings, it will not stop you. Because when the emotional meets the intelligent, the emotional will win. Now, what if I could find a way to live where I already feel better? What if I could find a way to live where my emotions do not build up to the level where they will trigger the mental twist, sending me reeling into the food? What if I could find a way to live where I already feel better, and the question is answered by, if I have a spiritual awakening as the result of the steps, which is what this is all about, Charlie Brown. This is about substituting the effect of the food for the effect of the spiritual awakening, and God will do for you slowly what the food does for you instantly, but with none of the devastating side effects. None of them. And if you will work this program to the best of your ability, you will not want to eat compulsively. The idea of doing that will not enter your mind. Now, some of you are just saying, wow, wow. I see like 10 of you going, wow, wow, wow. It's not such a wow. There are people in this room. One of them is wearing sunglasses. I don't know why. But he didn't get up this morning fighting food. I guarantee you he didn't. Did you? He didn't get up this morning thinking, I'm not going to eat ice cream today. I'm not going to eat ice cream today. Did you? It's the furthest thing from his mind because he has had a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps. And he and I and others can refrain from compulsive overeating, and we can do so happily. Let's look at the very next paragraph. And this next paragraph is something we're going to be talking about for the rest of our lives. We learn this paragraph and we teach this paragraph to the people that we sponsor. Ellie, there's some chairs right up here if you want. No? Okay. Okay. Yeah. It's after 10:20. Bear with me. If you need to take a break, take it. But we're on a roll. We're going to keep going. Those time frames were given to me by the committee. And if you know anything about me, I pretty much ignore them. We're on the bottom of XXVIII, 28 Roman numerals. Men and women drink essentially because they like the effect produced by alcohol. And we talked about that effect. That effect is that sense of ease and comfort that comes instantly from eating the food. That's what the food is doing for me that it doesn't do for the normal person. We've talked about a lot about what the food does to me. Let's talk about what it does for me. We just covered that in the last thing. It gives me that sense of ease and comfort that comes instantly from eating it. The sensation is so elusive that while they admit it is injurious, they cannot, after time, differentiate the true from the false. What is he talking about there, the true from the false? Does that mean that you think that New Hampshire is actually west of Oklahoma? No. It means that you cannot look at a bag of Oreos and think you're going to eat just one or two and be done with it and eat one or two. You lie to yourself. You tell yourself you're just going to have one or two, but you know damn well you're going to eat the whole bag. Who are you kidding? You're not kidding us. You're maybe kidding yourself. To them, their alcoholic life seems the only normal one. When they're not eating, they're restless, irritable, and discontented unless they can experience the sense of ease and comfort which comes at once by taking a few drinks, drinks which they see others taking with impunity. And impunity just means indifference. After they have succumbed to the desire again, as so many do, and the phenomenon of craving develops, they pass through the well-known stages of a spree, emerging remorseful, with a firm resolution not to drink again. This is repeated over and over, and unless this person can experience an entire spiritual awakening, there is very little hope of his recovery. On the other hand, and strange as this may seem to those who do not understand, once a psychic change has occurred, the very same person who seemed doomed, who had so many problems he despaired of ever solving them, suddenly finds himself easily able to control his desire for alcohol, the only effort necessary being that required to follow a few simple rules. What are the rules? There's 12 of them. The steps. Very good. That's exactly the right answer. Men have cried out to me in sincere and despairing appeal. Doctor, I cannot go on like this. I have everything to live for. I must stop, but I cannot. You must help me. Faced with this problem, if a doctor is honest with himself, he must sometimes feel his own inadequacy. Although he gives all that is in him, it is often not enough. One feels that something more than human power is needed to produce the essential psychic change, spiritual awakening. Though the aggregate of recoveries resulting from psychiatric effort is considerable, we physicians must admit we have made little impression upon the problem as a whole. Many types do not respond to the ordinary psychological approach. I do not hold with those who believe alcoholism is entirely a problem of mental control. And there he is again bringing up the physical factor, which in its time was extremely controversial, very controversial information. Okay? I have had many men who have had, for example, worked a period of months on some problem or business deal which was to be settled on a certain date favorably to them. They took a drink a day or so prior to the date, and the phenomenon of craving at once became paramount to all other interests, so that the important appointment was not met. What was it that caused these people to drink? The buildup of emotions, and the emotions that built up triggered the mental twist. The mental twist insisted, drove them into the food, and then the physical, or into the liquor, and the physical allergy made it impossible for them to stop. So if they can't drink because of the allergy, and they cannot keep from drinking because of the mental twist, they are powerless over alcohol, and their lives are unmanageable. They are powerless over alcohol, and their life is unmanageable. There are many situations which arise out of the phenomenon of craving which cause men to make the supreme sacrifice rather than continue to fight. And I was banging on the door of death. I wasn't knocking on it. I was kicking it in at 700 pounds. $150 a day worth of food, size 80-inch waist. I was kicking the door in on death. And I was not going to fight. And it was a miracle that resurrected me. It was absolutely a miracle. I stand here in front of you today, and I will tell you that it was only by the grace of God that I reached feebly for any recovery at all whatsoever. Because I didn't believe that this would work for me. I didn't know that there was a life beyond the food. And I didn't want that life. I didn't want it. I wanted to die. I couldn't fight anymore. And I'm still here today, and I want to live. I wasted decades of my life in this illness. And I'm not going to give it one more second. The classifications of alcoholics seem most difficult and in much detail is outside the scope of this book. There are, of course, the psychopaths who are emotionally unstable. We are all familiar with this type. They are always going on the wagon. They are always going on the wagon for keeps. They are over remorseful and make many resolutions but never a decision. Later today, we're going to find out that step three is both a beginning and a decision. A beginning and a decision is step three. So that means they didn't take the first few steps. There is the type of man who is unwilling to admit he cannot take a drink. He plans various ways of drinking. He changes his brand or his environment. There is the type who always believes that after being entirely free from alcohol for a period of time, he can take a drink without danger. There is the manic depressive type who is perhaps the least understood by his friends and about whom a whole chapter could be written. Then there are the types entirely normal in every respect, except in the effect alcohol has upon them. They are often able, intelligent, friendly people. All these and many others have one symptom in common. They cannot, they cannot start drinking without developing the phenomenon of craving. That craving is set up by the food or the alcohol going in the body, and that's the manifestation of the allergy. This phenomenon, as we have suggested, may be the manifestation of an allergy which differentiates these people and sets them apart as a distinct entity. It has never been, by any treatment with which we are familiar, permanently eradicated. The only relief we have to suggest is entire abstinence. And when he talks about this entire abstinence, what is he saying? Put down the food. Put down the food. Step away from the Kit Kat bar. Leave it alone. We'll have people from the OA police come and pick it up later. Is this where the Kit Kat bar was? We'll take that, ma'am. Okay. Now, this immediately precipitates us into a seething cauldron of debate. Much has been written pro and con, but among physicians, the general opinion seems to be that most chronic alcoholics are doomed. What is the solution? Perhaps I can best answer this by relating one of my experiences. About 1 year prior to this experience, a man was brought in to be treated for chronic alcoholism. He had but partially recovered from a gastric hemorrhage and seemed to be a case of pathological mental deterioration. He had lost everything worthwhile in life, was only living, one might say, to drink. He frankly admitted and believed that for him there was no hope. Following the elimination of alcohol, there was found to be no permanent brain injury.
He accepted the plan outlined in this book. 1 year later, he called to see me, and I experienced a very strange sensation. I knew the man by name and partly recognized his features, but there all resemblance ended. From a trembling, despairing, nervous wreck had emerged a man brimming over with self-reliance and contentment. I talked with him for some time, but was not able to bring myself to feel that I had known him before. To me, he was a stranger, and so he left me. A long time has passed with no return to alcohol. When I need a mental uplift, I often think of another case brought in by a physician prominent in New York. The patient had made his own diagnosis and, deciding his situation hopeless, had hidden in a deserted barn determined to die. He was rescued by a searching party and in desperate condition brought to me. Following his physical rehabilitation, he had had a talk with me in which he frankly stated he thought the treatment a waste of effort, unless I could assure him, which no one ever had, that in the future he would have the willpower to resist the impulse to drink. His alcoholic problem was so complex and his depression so great that we felt his only hope would be through what we then called moral psychology, and we doubted if even that would have any effect. However, he did become sold on the ideas contained in this book. He has not had a drink for a great many years. I see him now and then, and he is as fine a specimen of manhood as one could wish to meet. I earnestly advise every alcoholic to read this book through, and though perhaps he came to scoff, he may remain to pray. William D. Silkworth, M.D. Let's take 10 minutes and we'll come back for Bill's story. And on the bottom of page 8, he's going to find some things out, and he's going to come to some conclusions that are going to change not only his life, but our lives and the lives of countless millions of people forever. Bill Wilson was born in East Dorset, Vermont, on the 26th of November, 1895. His parents were Emily and Gilman Wilson. Gilman Wilson was an alcoholic. Gilman's father was an alcoholic. And Gilman's father went up to Mount Elias in Vermont and had a spiritual experience on the mountain of the wind blowing through and never found it necessary to drink again. But Bill's father, Gilman Griffith, his alcoholism weighed heavily on his marriage, and in 1906, after giving birth to two children, Emily Griffith divorced her husband. And Dorothy Wilson, who is 2 years younger than Bill, and Bill were raised by their grandparents in a rooming house in East Dorset, Vermont. And Fayette and Ella Griffith were Bill's maternal grandparents, and they raised him. Bill was a very scared child. Bill was a very determined child. He was thin, tall, gangly, but very determined to be successful. He read in a book that only an Aborigine could fashion a boomerang that would actually come back to you. And he worked tirelessly and fashioned a boomerang that did come back, and when it did, it almost killed his grandfather. He practiced at football and became co-captain of his school's football team. He practiced at baseball and became the starting shortstop of his school's baseball team. He found a violin in his grandfather's attic and became co-first chair of his school's orchestra. You can see a pattern of determination in Bill. Bill suffered from an inferiority complex, and he wanted desperately to prove to the world that he was important too. He wanted desperately to prove to himself that he could make something of himself in the world. Now, divorce in 1906 was not what divorce is today. I'm divorced 5 years, and I still have a little bit of a stigma that I'm a divorced guy, because I never really thought that would happen to me. But I am divorced, and so it just kind of like grates on me sometimes. But in 1906, divorce was quite scandalous. And so Bill always wore that. And he suffered from depression. When he was 17 years old, he fell in love with a girl named Bertha Bamford. This is before Lois. And he fell in love with a girl named Bertha Bamford.
And Bertha went to New York City from Vermont for what was deemed to be and told to Bill to be a very routine medical surgical procedure. She died. And at 17 years of age, Bill Wilson fell into the first of his many serious and deep depressions. Bill was a depressant his entire life, and this was something that he dealt with. Bill was 43 years old when the big book was written, with 3.5 years of sobriety. One of the things that I will always believe is that God wrote the book. The reason that I believe that God wrote the book is because Bill and the many of the early AA members, Oxford Group, Drunk Squad members and AA members who contributed to the book by putting things in and taking things out and redoing things, they did not know enough to write what is one of the greatest pieces of spiritual literature that the world has ever seen. And the book that I'm holding in my hand right now has saved more drunks, saved more compulsive overeaters, more drug addicts, more sex addicts, more gamblers, more whatever, than all other methods of repair to these things combined. Nothing even approaches a fraction of the lives that have been saved by this book. This is one of the greatest pieces of spiritual literature ever formulated, and I believe that God wrote it. He used Bill and the others to scribe it, but he wrote it. Because the stories in here and the ideas in here are so timeless that they are as meaningful to us in 2015 as they were in 1939, when the first, in April of 39, the book was written in 37 and 38 and published in April of 39. You couldn't give it away. But it has restored more people back to society than we can count. Let's take a look at the first couple of steps as they manifest through his story. And what I'm going to do the best I can to do is to make this in a way, or read it in a way, or bring it to life in a way that will make it less about Bill Wilson and more about you. More about you. Page 1. War fever ran high in the New England town to which we knew young officers from Plattsburgh. Plattsburgh is in upstate New York. Were assigned, and we were flattered when the first citizens took us to their homes, making us feel heroic. Here was love, applause, war, moments sublime with intervals hilarious. I was part of life at last, and in the midst of the excitement, I discovered liquor. I forgot the strong warnings and the prejudices of my people concerning drink. In time, we sailed for over there. Over there would denote World War I. Excuse me. I was very lonely and again turned to alcohol. We landed in England. I visited Winchester Cathedral. Much moved, I wandered outside. My attention was caught by a doggerel on an old tombstone. Here lies a Hampshire grenadier who caught his death drinking cold small beer. A good soldier is ne'er forgot, whether he dieth by musket or by pot. Now, the pot that he is talking about is not marijuana. It is beer. So here is a guy who literally drank himself to death. And the thing that we want to remember is that in England, ironically, the man whose tombstone this is, his name is Thatcher. And that Thatcher name is a name that we're going to be talking about when we get to page 8. But they drank beer in England in pint pots and quart pots. And it was considered very bad manners to actually sit and drink. And they would be in the saloon or in the inn, and there would be a bar that the guys could lean against while they were drinking, and that's why it's called a bar. And you can even see to this day, here is a bar stool that I've been sitting on. A bar stool, as an homage to those days, is always raised above the level of a kitchen chair, a dining room chair, or a living room chair. It's always raised as an homage to those days. And when they would drink in the quart pots and in the pint pots, the barkeeper would say, watch your pints and quarts over there. You guys are getting a little bit out of hand. And as that expression came to the colonies in the 16 and 1700s, that expression came and became, watch your P's and Q's. And that's where that comes into our language today. So you can see we give you etymology, we give you Yiddish, we give you everything, you know, that you need to know to carry on with your recovery here. Okay, ominous warning, which I failed to heed. 22, and a veteran of foreign wars, I went home at last. I fancied myself a leader, for had not the men of my battery given me a special token of appreciation, my talent for leadership, I imagine, would place me at the head of vast enterprises, which I would manage with the utmost assurance. I took a night law course and obtained employment as investigator for a surety company. The drive for success was on. I'd proved to the world I was important. My work took me about Wall Street, and little by little I became interested in the market. Many people lost money, but some became very rich. Why not I? I studied economics and business as well as law. Potential alcoholic that I was, I nearly failed my law course. At one of the finals, I was too drunk to think or write. Now, what are we seeing here? See if this doesn't relate to you. Bill's alcoholism is now dictating his life. Bill is reaching out his hand to become an attorney. And his alcoholism says, no attorney for you, Bill. I don't know about you, but every dream I ever dreamed, every aspiration I ever had in my entire life was annihilated in the face of my constant desire to eat more food. All I ever wanted to be was thin, but all I ever wanted to do was eat. And there was nothing in my life in the way of a fulfillment of a dream, because my dreams went up in smoke, my friends went up in smoke, my life went up in smoke when they tried to compete with my attention or vie for my efforts. And it was between a Kit Kat bar and any dream I had ever dreamed in my life, the Kit Kat bar won in a walk. And Bill wants to be an attorney, but he's too drunk to think or write. And so you can see that in the life of Bill, how this is going to affect the course of his life. And he says here, though my drinking was not yet continuous, it disturbed my wife. We had long talks when I would still her forebodings by telling her that men of genius conceive their best projects when drunk, that the most majestic constructions of philosophic thought were so derived. What is he doing there? What's the first victim of this illness? The truth. The first thing to go out the window when this illness manifests in your life is honesty. There are four things that all active addicts do constantly. They lie. They assign blame. They keep score in their relationships, and they fight battles that just don't exist. They lie. They assign blame. They keep score in their relationships, and they fight battles that just don't exist. And these are the things we do, and we don't even know we're doing them. They just make perfect sense. They make perfect sense to us. And so he's lying to Lois. He's lying to himself, but he doesn't know what else to do. He wants to stop drinking. He wants to want to stop drinking, but he's not there yet because alcohol is still doing more for him than it is to him. And while the food worked for you, we can't touch you. Unless you're ready, we cannot touch you. But when you're ready, we're here. We're here for you. By the time I had completed the By the time I had completed the course, I knew the law. Right, Linda? Okay. The inviting maelstrom of Wall Street had me in its grip. Business and financial leaders were my heroes. Out of this alloy of drink and speculation, I commenced to forge the weapon that one day would turn in its flight like a boomerang and all but cut me to ribbons. Living modestly, my wife and I saved $1,000. Now, let's look at the context of what we're talking about here. We're talking about the 1920s, and he has managed to save $1,000. Now, you may think $1,000, pish-posh, I've got credit cards in my pocket with limits greater than $1,000. But in the 1920s, $1,000 is a heck of a lot of money. In the city of Chicago, at that time, you could get a brand new Ford or a brand new Dodge for $495. At that time, in the city of Chicago, you could buy a freestanding house for about $1,500-$1,600. And I'm not talking a schlock neighborhood or a schlock house. I'm talking a nice neighborhood and a nice house for $1,500-$1,600. So anybody that could save $1,000 in the 1920s was making a very nice amount of money. Okay, so that's why I bring that about. You can read past that and not think that it's a lot. It's a lot. It went into certain securities, then cheap and rather unpopular. I rightly imagine that they would someday have a great rise. I failed to persuade my broker friends to send me out looking over factories and management, but my wife and I decided to go anyway. I had developed a theory that most people lost money in stocks through ignorance of markets. I discovered many more reasons later on. Now, what was happening there is the market was so healthy. The 1920s and the 1950s were two of the most unbelievable growth periods in this nation's history. You literally could put a chimpanzee in the chair and say to the chimp, "Bobo, throw the dart." And if Bobo threw the dart and it hit a stock and you invested in it on about a 10% margin, you'd probably make money. But Bill Wilson, he saw this and he knew inherently that this is going to come crashing down. And he went to people and he said, "We need more information." And so, of course, they said, "No, we don't need that." Well, Bill was cunning, baffling, and powerful too. So what did he do? And you can see pictures of this on the internet. You can see it in AA Comes of Age. That's a conference-approved book, so don't yell at me for that. Okay. You can see pictures of it, how they went to these companies, and Bill was such a master manipulator. He was so cunning, baffling, and powerful that he'd get these guys in the bar near the company, and he'd elicit all this information from them. He'd go back to this tent, he'd write all this stuff down, and he'd send it in to these guys, and they're looking at it going, "You know what? This is fantastic stuff." He was an innovator. He was very, very smart. He wasn't really a New York stockbroker. He was a New York City stock speculator who made his living selling his opinions to other people for a cut of the profit. And he would tell them that he thinks they should invest in this and not in this and this and not in this. And this is how he made his living. And it's working for him. He's drinking, but it seems to be working for him right now. Let's see where we go from there. Bottom of page 2. "We gave up our positions and off we roared on a motorcycle, the sidecar stuffed with tent blankets, a change of clothes, and 3 huge volumes of a financial reference service." Beverly, we got one right there. Change of clothes and 3 used volumes of a financial reference service. "Our friends thought a lunacy commission should be appointed. Perhaps they were right. I had had some success at speculation, so we had a little money, but we once worked on a farm for a month to avoid drawing on our small capital. That was the last honest manual labor on my part for many a day. We covered the whole eastern United States in a year. By the end of it, my reports to Wall Street procured me a position there and the use of a large expense account. The exercise of an option brought in more money, leaving us with a profit of several $1,000s for that year." So anybody that's making that kind of money is wealthy. Anybody that's making that kind of money, you better listen to that person. Remember those old commercials, E.F. Hutton or something? When E.F. Hutton talks, everybody listens. Well, when Bill is talking, people are listening. People are enthralled by what he has to say because he's successful. He is very, very successful. And the drinking is working for him, and it's not a problem yet. "The next few years, fortune threw money and applause my way. I had arrived. Here's the kid from East Dorset, Vermont. Never had a nickel in his life. Came from divorced parents. Came from a little tiny town in Vermont. And here he is. He's one of the princes of Wall Street. And he's married to Lois. And his life is working. And things are good. I had arrived. What a feeling. What an exhilaration he had when he can write the words, I had arrived. Let's see where he goes from there, because drinking is still working for Bill Wilson, isn't it? My judgment and ideas were followed by many to the tune of paper millions. Now let's take a look at that sentence. My ideas were followed by many to the tune of paper millions. Now could you just imagine Monday morning when you go back into your life, whatever it is you do for a living becomes the standard. Whatever you do for a living becomes the right way. Whatever you do becomes something to aspire to. People are listening to him and they're investing millions of dollars based on his opinion. Can you just imagine what that would do for your ego if that was you? And the drinking is still working for Bill Wilson, isn't it? It hasn't become a problem yet. But wait. Drink was taking an important and exhilarating part in my life. There was loud talk in the jazz places uptown. Everyone spent in thousands and chattered in millions. Scoffers could scoff and be damned. I made a host of fair weather friends. So these fair weather friends, they're buddying it up to him. They want what he has, right? Now, it's all working for him. Let's see where he goes. My drinking assumed more serious proportions, continuing all day and almost every night. The remonstrances of my friends terminated in a row, and I became a lone wolf. Now, can I relate to Bill Wilson? Because the remonstrances means that these people are getting on him about his drinking. If I spit on you, I'm sorry. It's part of the danger of sitting up in front. But the bottom line is that the remonstrances means these people are getting on him about his drinking, and a row is a fight. A row is a disturbance. It's not row like row, row, row your boat. It's row. And he's telling them to kiss his Royal American. He's going to drink. He doesn't care. He doesn't need these people. The heck with these people. And how many times were my dreams right there? How many times were the friends right there? How many times were these situations right there? But I couldn't breach the gap. I couldn't get over there to grab it because I kept getting pulled back by the food because I wanted what was up there, but I had to have the food. I wanted what was up there, but I demanded the food because my mental twist had been activated by emotions, drove me into the food, and it made those dreams go up in smoke. Who wouldn't lose faith? Who wouldn't lose confidence? Who wouldn't want to die? Who would want to live in this world where everything I ever wanted was right there and I couldn't have any of it? So of course I struggled with step two. Let's go on. There were many unhappy scenes in our sumptuous apartment. There had been no real infidelity, for loyalty to my wife, helped at times by extreme drunkenness, kept me out of those scrapes. I'm not so sure I should comment on that, so let's keep going. Let's suffice to say that Bill Wilson was very human. He was a human being. He was a man. In 1929, I contracted golf fever. We went at once to the country, my wife to applaud, while I started out to overtake Walter Hagen. Think Tiger Woods or whoever. Walter Hagen was a big golfer. Liquor caught up with me much faster than I came up behind Walter. I began to be very jittery in the morning. Golf permitted drinking every day and every night, and it was fun to carom around the exclusive course which had inspired such awe in me as a lad. I acquired the impeccable coat of tan one sees upon the well-to-do. The local banker watched me whirl fat checks in and out of his till with amused skepticism. Abruptly, in October 1929, this would be Black Tuesday, this is the 29th of October 1929, when the world changed. This is the start of the Great Depression. This is the beginning of the entire collapse, or this is the end mark of the entire collapse, not the beginning. Hell broke loose on the New York Stock Exchange after one of those days of inferno. I wobbled from a hotel bar to a brokerage office. It was 8 o'clock, 5 hours after the market closed. The ticker still clattered. I was staring at an inch of tape which bore the inscription XYZ32. It had been 52 that morning. I was finished, and so were many friends. The papers reported men jumping to death from the towers of high finance. That disgusted me. I would not jump. I went back to the bar. Now, I want you to make mental note of how disgusted he is. Mark where I am. Where he is, basically around the suicide. Why were these people jumping off the building? Why were these people killing themselves? Because their God was dead. They saw no reason to go on living. The stock market had crashed. Everything they owned, everything they had worked for, everything that they had aspired to was up in flames. But Bill was disgusted by the suicide. Make note of that. We're going to come back to that. But what did Bill know without knowing it? He went back where? To the bar. Why? Because the bar had liquor, and the liquor would do something for Bill. For Bill, not to him, for him, which would restore his courage. That liquor could give him an almost psychotic delusional effect, so that by drinking the liquor, he would see the reality of the world in a very different way. He was removed from it in identically the way that a Kit Kat bar or Raisinets or ice cream will remove me from reality. When I eat chocolate, when I eat pie, I do not see the world as it is. I see the world as I want it to be. It comes alive like Dorothy in Oz. All of a sudden, she's in this black and white kind of situation there with the uncle and the aunt and the whole thing. And then all of a sudden she wakes up and she's in Oz and everything is in color. You give me enough Chicago style pizza, you give me some ice cream, and everything is groovy, man. Everything is beautiful. Because that's the effect. And we talked about that in the doctor's opinion. And if there's anything you're going to notice in the big book, is that the thread, the tapestry, is going to wind itself from chapter to chapter to page, and that without that knowledge of the doctor's opinion, we cannot understand why he would want to go back to the bar, because the liquor would change his perception of reality. And that's what food does for me, that it doesn't do for the normal eater. Food does something for me that it doesn't do for Ned and Nancy normal out there. It just changes everything. And so will recovery. My friends had dropped several million since 10 o'clock. So what? Tomorrow was another day. As I drank, the old fierce determination to win came back. Next morning, I telephoned a friend in Montreal. This would be his friend, Dick Johnson. He had plenty of money left and thought I had better go to Canada. By the following spring, we were living in our accustomed style. I felt like Napoleon returning from Elba. No St. Helena for me, but drinking caught up with me again, and my generous friend had to let me go. This time, we stayed broke. St. Helena was where Napoleon was banished to, and Elba was the island he was on when he came and reconquered Europe. So he was going there, and he said, no St. Helena for me, and he's going to reconquer things. And where does he get his courage? He gets his courage from the liquor. I got my courage from peanut M&Ms. I got my courage from chocolate milkshakes. I got my courage from pie. And I would sit there at 400, 500, 600 pounds eating pie, and I looked in the mirror, and I saw Steve McQueen. I looked in the mirror, and I saw James Bond. I looked in the mirror, and I saw Napoleon Solo, the man from Uncle, and I looked at all these things, and people are looking around going, who's Napoleon Solo? Who's the man from Uncle? Look him up on Google. I'm 60 years old. I have points of reference that are different than some of you. Okay? I have different points of reference. My God. Come on. You got to work with me here. But drinking caught up with me again, and my generous friend had to let me go. This time we stayed broke. We went to live with my wife's parents. Now, I want to tell you something here so you'll understand. You live in a world today, in 2015, that is very different than the world Bill Wilson was living in 1930. 1931, 32. You live in a world where if you go live with your wife's parents or you go live with your husband's parents, you don't want it. It's not optimal, but it happens, and it's okay. This is the 1930s. The world was a different place. Not only was the world a different place, but Bill Wilson understood something as a little boy that we all get taught over a certain age. Girls may fall in love with you, but they're not going to starve to death for you. They won't live in a tent with you. They won't live under a park bench with you. If you're going to be a man, you're going to have to put clothes on her back. You're going to have to put a roof over her head. And every once in a while, you're going to have to take her someplace nice. That's what you're told as a little boy growing up. Okay? Now, Bill Wilson was the Prince of Wall Street. And Dr. Burnham, Lois's father, hates Bill's guts. Because Lois, his daughter, his precious child, had ectopic pregnancy. And ectopic pregnancy meant that she was bleeding out on the table, and they got her to the hospital, she's bleeding out on the table, and Yutz is nowhere to be found. And Dr. Burnham is looking for this guy in every gin joint, in every hellhole there is, and he can't find him. And he hated Bill. And here's Bill Wilson, the Prince of Wall Street, who's going to take care of his daughter, who swore to God, in front of God and his children, that he would provide for Lois, and he has nothing. He has nothing but a drunken bum he is, and they're coming in there to live with the Burnhams. This is horrific in Bill's life. He's extremely unhappy, and he feels very defeated. Now, you have to understand, and I don't want to go into a whole history lesson here because we don't have the time and it's not the purpose of this. You had a time recently in the United States of America where you had 10% unemployment, 12% unemployment, and people were up in arms. This was a period of time when you had 30, 35% unemployment. You have soup kitchens. You have bread lines. This was the Depression, baby. 33, 35% unemployment. And the world is on its ear. And here comes Bill living with Dr. and Mrs. Burnham, and they hate him. I found a job, then lost it as a result with a brawl with a taxi driver. Mercifully, no one could guess that I was to have no real employment for 5 years or hardly draw a sober breath. My wife began to work in a department store, coming home exhausted to find me drunk. So here's Lois going to work at Lohman's. She's making $19 a week. Plus commission, she's bringing home about $20, $26, $27 a week. She's leaving in the morning. He stinks to high hell. He hasn't bathed. He hasn't shaved. He hasn't changed his clothes. She asks him nicely, "Would you please put the breakfast dishes in the sink and clean yourself up?" She comes home after a hard day of standing on her feet on high heels for 10, 12 hours a day. He still stinks to high hell on the couch. He hasn't shaved, hasn't showered, hasn't changed his clothes, and the breakfast dishes are still sitting on the kitchen table. Can you just imagine what their domestic life was like? Can you just imagine how strong his urge to drink was to take away the horrible pain of drinking? And for me in my life, eating more food was often the only alternative I had to the pain of eating too much food. So the more food I ate, the more pain I had. The more pain I had, the more food I ate. The more food I ate, the more shame and pain I had, and the more food I ate, and it was just an endless cycle. It was just an endless, endless cycle that only a munificent, benevolent God could have interrupted. I became an unwelcome hanger-on at brokerage places. Liquor ceased to be a luxury. It became a necessity. I've often wanted to do this. I do a lot of retreats around the nation. I do a lot of retreats around the country, as I told you before. I've often wanted to do a retreat just on this sentence alone. Just this: liquor ceased to be a luxury. It became a necessity. Food went from when I was 3 years old from a luxury to a necessity where I was eating around the clock. Bathtub gin, 2 bottles a day and often 3 got to be routine. Sometimes a small deal would net a few $100s and I would pay my bills at the bars and delicatessens. This went on endlessly and I began to waken very early in the morning, shaking violently. A tumbler full of gin followed by 6 bottles of beer would be required. The key word there is required. If I were to eat any breakfast, nevertheless, I still thought I could control the situation, and there were periods of sobriety which renewed my wife's hope. What is Bill doing there that we know so well? He's going on a diet. Thank you, Allie. He's going on a diet. He's absolutely trying to control his drinking while he's drinking because that's the only thing he knows to do. He's going to go on a diet. And so since he stayed sober for 25 minutes, it renews his wife's hope. Gradually, things got worse. The house was taken over by the mortgage holder. My mother-in-law died. My wife and father-in-law became ill. Then I got a promising business opportunity. Stocks were at a low point of 1932, and I had somehow formed a group to buy. I was to share generously in the profits. Then I went on a prodigious bender, and the chance vanished. This is a story within the story that takes place in Cherry Hill, New Jersey. And I did a retreat in Mount Laurel, New Jersey, not long ago. And I actually ate dinner on the Saturday night in Cherry Hill, New Jersey. But these people from Cherry Hill approached Bill Wilson, and they approached him with the purpose of putting together a stock purchase because stocks were at a low point, as it says in the story. And they said something to him, and they said, but watch your drinking, Wilson, because we've heard about your drinking, and we don't want to deal with that on this deal. And he was on one of his diets, and he didn't know anything about alcoholism. And he says, no, you don't have to worry about that. I don't drink that way anymore, right? You don't have to worry about M&Ms. I don't eat them anymore, right? Yeah, right. So the bottom line is, he says, don't worry about that. And they meet in this hotel room in Cherry Hill. One of the guys has a bottle of moonshine whiskey. Remember, this is in the days of Prohibition. And how many of you have gone to your aunt's house or your friend's house and they say, oh, no, this is vegan. You can have this. Oh, no, this is vegetarian. Oh, no, this is kosher. I made this myself. I made this for you. And so you pop it in your mouth. And with no more thought than that, you're off to the races. And this is what happens to Bill. They're sitting in this hotel room, and the guy says, wait a minute, Wilson, because the jug passed around once. He didn't take any. Comes around again. The guy says, hey, Wilson, I made this myself. This is Jersey Lightning. You can have one drink. Bill figures, okay. He has one drink of Jersey Lightning, and he didn't come out of that room for 3 days. He was so drunk. And now he's got to go back to Lois, and he's got to tell her again, I'm sorry, dear, I got drunk again. And Bill would write in the Bible every year, my dearest Lo, this is the year I'm going to not listen to John Barleycorn. My dearest Lo, I love you with all my heart. I'm not going to tally anymore at the wine. I'm not going to drink anymore, my dear one. And every time he made those promises to her, he broke them because of an allergy of the body and a twist of the mind that he neither understood nor could he control. He didn't cause it. He can't cure it. He can't control it. How many of you in this room are compulsive overeaters? How many of you are ashamed of it? A few of you, you're playing God. You had nothing to do with it. Nothing to do with it. Absolutely nothing to do with it. You didn't cause it. You can't control it. And you cannot cure it. Exonerate yourself. Exonerate yourself. You had nothing to do with it. It isn't because you're stupid. It isn't because you're left-handed or right-handed. It isn't because you're black or white, Jew or Gentile. That has nothing to do with it. It happened. Now what are you going to do? What are you going to do now? Okay. I woke up. This had to be stopped. I saw I could not take as much as one drink. I was through forever. Before then, I had written lots of sweet promises, but my wife happily observed that this time I meant business, and so I did. Shortly afterward, I came home drunk. There had been no fight. Where had been my high resolve? I simply didn't know. It hadn't even come to mind. Someone had pushed a drink my way and I had taken it. Was I crazy? I began to wonder, for such an appalling lack of perspective seemed near being just that. Renewing my resolve, going back on my diet, I tried again. Some time passed and confidence began to be replaced by cocksuredness. I could laugh at the gin mills. Now I had what it takes. One day I walked into a cafe to telephone. Wait a minute. He walked into a cafe to telephone. They didn't have a phone at the jewelry store. They didn't have a phone at the funeral parlor. They didn't have a phone at the clothing store or the barber shop. He has to go into the cafe to make a call. Why? He's on one of his diets. But he was drunk before he walked in the damn door because he's looking to steal that vicarious thrill. He was looking in his mind to establish the story. You all have your stories of why you were at the grocery store, why you were at McDonald's, why you were at the House of Pies, whatever it is. Why you were there? Well, I was just there to make a call. Well, he just happened to go to a cafe to make a telephone call. Why? Because the mental twist inside of him was driving him into that cafe because it was in search of the effect. It was in search of that effect. He goes into the cafe to make a telephone call. So he's got his story, right? Okay. In no time, I was beating on the bar, asking myself how it happened. As the whiskey rose to my head, I told myself I'd manage better next time, but I might as well get good and drunk then. And I did. What caused Bill to take the first drink? The mental twist. What caused Bill to take the 20th drink? The physical allergy. The physical allergy. And if you can't drink because of the allergy, and you can't keep from drinking because of the twist of the mind, you are powerless over alcohol and your life is unmanageable. I can't eat 2 Oreo cookies. Why? Because of the allergy. I can't keep from eating Oreo cookies. Why? Because of the mental twist. And the mental twist is awakened by the buildup of emotions, which all human beings have. All human beings have those emotions, and we talked about that before. But as my emotions build and build and build and build and build, it'll knock on the door of the mental twist, and the mental twist will send me into the food for the relief of that untenable pain that comes about in my heart and in my soul and in my head as the result of not eating the food. The problem for the compulsive overeater is when you're not eating. That pain is too much to bear. And you cannot bear it anymore. You cannot bear it anymore. Okay. I hope that Bill's story is coming alive and it's more your story than it is his. I hope that we're weaving you into the story. Okay? Where am I? Linda, help me. Oh, thank you. The remorse, horror, and hopelessness of the next morning are unforgettable. The courage to do battle was not there. My brain raced uncontrollably, and there was a terrible sense of impending calamity. I hardly dare cross the street, lest I collapse and be run down by an early morning truck, for it was scarcely daylight. An all-night place supplied me with a dozen glasses of ale. My writhing nerves were stilled at last, and morning paper told me the market had gone to hell again. So had I. The market would recover, but I wouldn't. That was a hard thought. Should I kill myself? Here he is thinking about it, right? I just told you, make note of how he's looking at the guys committing suicide. He's considering it now because he's out of ideas. He doesn't know what else to do. He's cornered by his alcoholism and he can't get out. Should I kill myself? No, not now. Then a mental fog settled down. Gin would fix that. So 2 bottles and oblivion. And now he's drinking for the most serious. He's drinking for oblivion, and I was eating for oblivion. I would wake up in the morning in those last days, and I would begin eating more calories in the first hour I was awake than most families of 4 would eat in a week. I can remember very, very distinctly, very, very distinctly, eating a dozen donuts, eating 2 dozen donuts, 3 dozen donuts, whatever it is, even before most people were out of bed in the morning, because I couldn't take that pain. I wasn't conscious of that. I thought I was hungry. I would start eating them, and I would go and go and go and go. Two bottles and oblivion. He's drinking for oblivion. He's thinking about killing himself now because he has nowhere else to go. The mind and body are marvelous mechanisms, for mine endured this agony 2 more years. I have a wonderful cardiologist in Scottsdale. He's a great guy. And he'll say to me when he walks in the room, and he'll say, "How's the miracle man today?" I have a condition called atrial fibrillation. I have a severely enlarged left atrium, and that causes AFib, which is called AFib in common slang. So I have to take blood thinners every day. But he says, other than that, you're a miracle. He says, "I can't believe you're still above ground. I can't believe you're still alive." He says, "Here's my miracle, man." And the last time, you know, I get so scared from the doctor visit because, you know, doctors to me, they're going to scream, they're going to yell. He put his arm on my shoulder and he says, "Just keep doing what you're doing. You're doing great." He says, "You're doing so good." And, you know, they did a imaging of my heart the last time I was there, and they did my EKG. And he says, "You're doing great. You're doing great. Just keep doing what you're doing." I'm not even used to hearing that. I'm not used to hearing any of that. And those are the miracles I extend out to you. And if those miracles are there for me, they're there for you. But let's look at Bill Wilson. And it says, "The mind and body are marvelous mechanisms, for mine endured this agony 2 more years. Other than the physical manifestations of this disease, I don't know how I kept from killing myself from sheer loneliness. The sheer isolation which my morbid obesity wrought into my life. I went on my first date with a girl. I was 35 years old. How did I stand the loneliness? How did I stand the isolation? No human touch, no human companionship, no human anything like that. Totally isolated. And how I survived is a miracle. Sometimes I stole from my wife's slender purse. When the morning terror and madness were on me, again I swayed dizzily before an open window or the medicine cabinet where there was poison, cursing myself for a weakling. There were flights from city to country and back. The Burnhams had money. Lois was a Burnham, I told you that. And they had money. So they had homes in the country, and they had a home in the city. So sometimes when he was drinking in the city, they would go to the country. And when he was drinking in the country, they would go to the city. And, he's thinking of killing himself, but they did a lot of geographics. Well, guess where that landed him? Nowhere. As my wife and I sought escape. Then came the night when the physical and mental torture were so hellish, I feared I would burst through my window sash and all. Somehow I managed to drag my mattress to a lower floor, lest I suddenly leap. A doctor came with a heavy sedative. Next day found me drinking both gin and sedative. This combination soon landed me on the rocks. People feared for my sanity. So did I. I could eat little or nothing when drinking, and I was 40 pounds underweight. Is his being 40 pounds underweight or some of the overweight conditions we've had from food any different? Absolutely not. Absolutely not. Now, let's look at the next, when we look at the next paragraph, we are going to start to see the hand of God reaching into the freezing cold dark cave of addiction and start to flicker a light. We're going to see God start to become more evident in making it so that we could be here at the 55th birthday of Overeaters Anonymous. And he's going to create in the lives of different people different miracles. And he is going to do this, and he's going to make sure that it's so subtle that it takes a little bit of study to see his hand in this. Now, I want you to remember that Bill's mother, when they divorced, I already told you that they divorced, Bill's father went out to Western Canada. Vermont has granite, marble, and lumber. He went out to Western Canada where there's granite, marble, and lumber. But Bill's mother moved to Boston, and she became one of the nation's first female osteopathic physicians. So she had a little money. Now, let's take a look at the next paragraph to see how God is going to move his hand into the lives of them, and in so doing, he's going to move his hand into the lives of us who suffer today from compulsive overeating. It says there, my brother-in-law is a physician, and through his kindness and that of my mother, I was placed in a nationally known hospital for the mental and physical rehabilitation of alcoholics. Of all the hospitals that Bill Wilson could have been placed in, he is placed in the Towns Hospital in New York City, the finest facility of its kind in the country. And Bill was not a rich man anymore, to say the least. He is placed there. And of all the doctors on staff at Towns, who is the doctor that he is going to be assigned to? Let's find out. Under the so-called belladonna treatment, my brain cleared. Hydrotherapy and mild exercise helped much. Best of all, I met a kind doctor, Silkworth, who explained that though certainly selfish and foolish, I had been seriously ill bodily, the allergy, and mentally, the twist of the mind. So we see the hand of a loving God, and we see the hand of God reaching to us even though we weren't born yet, most of us. We see his loving hand right there, that of all the places he could have been assigned, he goes to Towns. Of all the doctors on staff at Towns, he gets assigned to Silkworth. And Dr. Silkworth tells him of his theory that it is an allergy of the body and a twist of the mind. Now, is Bill Wilson the first person that Dr. Silkworth tells this to? We don't know. We're assuming not. But we're going to find out after lunch. We're not ready for lunch yet. Take it easy. What we're going to find out after lunch is that Bill Wilson is going to be the very first person in the history of planet Earth, not only to get the information on the problem, but he's going to get the information on the solution to the problem, and he's going to be the very first human being in the history of Earth to take the information of the problem and the information of the solution and move it forward so that we could be here today. Let's take a look at what has to ensue before that synthesis comes about, before that puzzle comes together, okay? It relieved me somewhat to learn that in alcoholics, the will is amazingly weakened when it comes to combating liquor. And that's why when I had you put your hands up, if you're ashamed of being a compulsive overeater, this is your emancipation proclamation. Let me read it again. It relieved me somewhat to learn that in alcoholics, the will is amazingly weakened when it comes to combating liquor. And I bet that if I had the time to get to know each and every one of you in this room right now, or anybody and everybody listening on the podcast that's going to listen to this in the future if they have nothing else to do, I would be amazed at some of the things you've accomplished. I would be amazed at some of the things you've done in your life. My God, I would just be stunned at some of the professions you've mastered. Some of you have raised families, and some of you have gone to... You've gone to school and you've graduated with advanced degrees and you've accomplished so much and all this other stuff. I would be astounded. But you know, there's one thing you cannot do. You cannot control the amount you eat once you've started, and you cannot keep from eating on your own now that you want to if you have this illness. Because when it comes to combating liquor, the will is amazingly weakened. Let's take that blame off of ourselves, and let's understand we're not responsible for the illness, but we are responsible for working the steps. We're responsible to seek and do the recovery. Okay. The will's amazingly combating liquor. Though it often remains strong in other respects, my incredible behavior in the face of a desperate desire to stop was explained. Understanding myself now, I fared forth in high hope. So he thinks now that he knows everything is going to be good. Excuse me. For 3 or 4 months, the goose hung high. The goose hung high is a symbol of prosperity. The goose hung high means times were good, or he was staying on his... Thank you. There you go. He was staying on his diet. Very good. Okay. I went to town regularly and even made a little money. Surely this was the answer, self-knowledge. So he's ready to roll. Now, this first hospitalization was in 1933, but it was not, for the frightful day came when I drank once more. The curve of my declining moral and bodily health fell off like a ski jump. After a time, I returned to the hospital, 1934. This was the finish, the curtain, it seemed to me. My weary and despairing wife was informed that it would all end with heart failure during delirium tremens, or I would develop a wet brain, perhaps within a year. A wet brain is really a dry brain. Alcohol dehydrates the cells, and in the liver and the brain, they don't repair themselves, so there's no way for the cell to rehydrate. And these guys with wet brain syndrome, man, at least Alzheimer's has the mercy to kill you. But wet brain, these guys can live that way for decades, and it's a horrible, horrible situation. Incidentally, though, it was a wet brain who named our organization. There was a guy in, his name was Worth, and he had been the publisher of New Yorker magazine, and he was in one of the jitter joints at the time that they were making the split, and we're going to talk about that later. And they're trying to think of a name for the book and a name for the fellowship. Well, they're bandying about the Bill W. movement, and that considered that for about 5 minutes, threw that one out. And then they says, well, comes the dawn. So they sent one of the guys, Fitz Mayhew, out to Washington, D.C., to the Library of Congress. And he says, well, there's about 12 books called Comes the Dawn, and they didn't want to be the 13th, so they gave that up. And this guy's in the back, and he says, Anonymous Alcoholics, Anonymous Alcoholics, Anonymous Alcoholics. And then in a moment of clarity, he says, Alcoholics Anonymous. And they says, yeah, that's what we're going to call it. So it was actually a wet brain that gave us the name Alcoholics Anonymous. God likes to laugh, too. He has a sense of humor, too. God has a very, very good sense of humor, and he loves to laugh. Okay, Linda, where am I? Thanks. She would soon have to give me over. Thanks. She would soon have to give me over to the undertaker or the asylum. They did not need to tell me. I knew and almost welcomed the idea. See, he's out of ideas. He doesn't want to live. It was a devastating blow to my pride. I, who had thought so well of myself and my abilities, of my capacity to surmount obstacles, was cornered at last. Now I was to plunge into the dark, joining the endless procession of sots who had gone on before. I thought of my poor wife. There had been much happiness after all. What would I not give to make amends, but that was over now. No words can tell of the loneliness and despair I found in that bitter morass of self-pity. Quicksand stretched around me in all directions. I had met my match. I had been overwhelmed. Alcohol was my master. Man, what a great description of step one. Alcohol was my master. Wow. Trembling, I stepped from the hospital a broken man. This is after hospitalization number two. Of the three that are in here, this is the end of two. Okay? Fear sobered me for a bit. Then came the insidious insanity of that first drink, and on Armistice Day, November 11th, that would be what you'd call Veterans Day, 1934, I was off again. Everyone became resigned to the certainty that I would have to be shut up somewhere or would stumble along to a miserable end. How dark it is before the dawn. In reality, that was the beginning of my last debauch. Now, here are some beautiful promises, and you don't have to wait for page 83 to get promises. Here are some. I was soon to be catapulted into what I like to call the fourth dimension of existence. I was to know happiness, peace, and usefulness in a way of life that is incredibly more wonderful as time passes. Near the end of that bleak November, I sat drinking in my kitchen. With a certain satisfaction, I reflected there was enough gin concealed about the house to carry me through that night and the next day. My wife was at work. I wondered whether I dared hide a full bottle of gin near the head of our bed. I would need it before daylight. Now, before I begin the next paragraph, we're going to go to lunch. After, if you want, we can do some Q&A. If not, I'll let you go. But I want to, when we come back from lunch, I'm going to tell you the backstory of what happens between this paragraph and the next paragraph, which is quite exciting. And what we're going to examine when we get back from lunch is how did step two come into the program? We see step one from Silkworth. Now we're going to get step two from a group of people who were unconcerned with alcoholism called the Oxford Group Movement. And these were people that were practicing, to the best of their ability, first century Christianity. And when we get back from lunch, and I don't know what time we convene, if it's 1:30 or 2, I don't know what, it's 2? 2 o'clock? Boy, that's a long lunch. Whew. Okay, that's fine. So at 2 o'clock, we're going to reconvene, and we're going to talk about the backstory on step 2. Now, I will take a couple of questions, but here's the rules. I got the microphone. I make the rules. Sorry. I do not take any food questions. I don't want to know what you eat, and discussing what I eat nauseates me. Number two, I do not take any questions about what you should do for someone else. Do your own 12-step work. With that in mind, if you ask me a food question, I'm just going to pass you by. We'll do a couple. Yeah.
Why didn't Lois leave?
She's a raving Al-Anon. She's a raving Al-Anon, yeah. Fight battles that just don't exist. Fight battles that just... Yes? No, I never work anything out of the 12 and 12. I work it out of the big book. That's the point of why we're doing a big book marathon rather than a 12 and 12 marathon. The 12 and 12 was written years later. It was written in 51 and 52, and it was published in 53. There was a series of articles in the Grapevine where Bill was trying to sell the traditions to the Fellowship of AA. The 12 and 12 had no instructions on how to work the steps. Those are essays about the steps. I work the steps out of the big book. That's the only place. We're reading them as we go. Come back this afternoon. We're reading them as we go. They couldn't be any more clear. Yes. If you do it rigorously and honestly, you could work through in just a matter of days. It doesn't take all that long. But then you do 10, 11, and 12 every day for the rest of your life. A woman came up to me in New Jersey, wants to know, can she call me when she's done with the steps? I said, no. She looked very quizzically, I said, because when you're done working the steps, you're dead. When they come to the conclusion that they are a compulsive overeater and they're powerless over food, if they're ready, if you're dragging them through it and you're trying to get them to do this, they're not ready, then leave them alone. Leave them alone. In Yiddish, it's called Muslim game. Leave them alone. No opinion on treatment centers. It's an outside issue. I'm sorry. I have no opinion on treatment centers. Yes? Can't cure it. Can't cure it. Yes?
Does meditation play a role in recovery?
Meditation is step 11. You bet it does. You bet it does. You bet it does. Yes? Those emotions build up, the hostess cupcakes will build up too. And you're yes.
Is mental bliss the same thing as having half a brain of being a nitwit?
No, it's not the same as being a nitwit. Bill Wilson was not a nitwit. I am not a nitwit. I am reasonably intelligent. A mental twist is that my brain has an unnatural way of directing me into the food as a way of relieving the pain of not eating. But there's many people in this room that have the mental twist that are anything but nitwits. They are brilliant, capable, educated people from all walks of life, all colors, all religions, and all races, and they are far from nitwits. They are brilliant, beautiful people, every one of them. Yeah. Oh, all right, you're cute. I'll let you. Get back to the big book and stop the other narishkeit. Stop the other narishkeit. Get back to the big book. That's where your steps are. You know, I'm not trying to... That's why you get questions about the 12 and 12. The 12 and 12 was written essays about the steps to sell the fellowship on the traditions. And even in the AA 12 and 12, those are essays about the steps. The instructions are in the big book, and they have never been anywhere else. And a lot of that stuff comes from this thirst we have for money. A huge percentage of the money we take in comes from the sale of literature. We would fill these rooms, and I'm very happy that you asked that question because I'm excited about the fact that we're going to get a beautiful attendance here at this OA birthday. But think for a minute what the attendance would be, and I don't want you guys throwing this in my face when I'm going to lunch. It's my opinion. I got the microphone. Think of how many people we would have here if the recovery was stronger. Think about the people we would have if the recovery was better and stronger and undiluted. You'd be holding these things in Dodger Stadium. Think about the number of people that you've seen come and go in your meetings.
Think about the people that are sitting beside you in your meeting and they are dying of their untreated addiction. They're dying in front of you. And they want to call their sponsor and say, I'm going to have the tuna surprise. Oh, and I don't know if I'm going to have a nectarine or an orange, but I'll call you back and let you know. Not a word about emotions. Not a word about fear, anger, selfishness, self-seeking, and dishonesty. Not a step. Now, I'm going to say something, and please, God, me, it's not about calling in your food and going to three meetings a week and making three outreach calls a day. Those are great things. Do them. I go to more than three meetings a week. I make tons of outreach calls. But for God's sakes, work the steps. Stop dieting with group support. Stop dieting with group support. I don't want to get calls from the committee. Please. Please, I don't want to get calls from the committee, but this is the answer to your question. Stop dieting with group support. Yes.
Do you attend AA meetings?
No, I'm not an alcoholic. I attend every day AA meetings except Friday. There's a Friday morning meeting about a block from my house. I can't make it because I'm working at that time, and normally I don't. But I lived in Eugene, Oregon for 9 years, and there is no AA. There's no such thing. So I had about a 9 years worth of AA. It turned out to be a blessing. It just turned out to be a blessing. But I haven't been to an AA meeting in many years since I moved to Arizona. There's no need for me to do that. I'm not an alcoholic. Yeah.
So does any of the OA literature help you?
If it helps you, use it. Does it help you? Then use it. You know, whether it helps me or not is not the issue. The AA literature, or excuse me, the AA big book, it's really the only piece of literature I need. It really is. That's the instruction manual. It's our basic text. If the OA literature is helping you, use it. If the OA literature is acting as a substitute for what you really need to do, then don't use it. Then don't use it. Yeah, one or two more, and then I'll check it. I want to share it with you. Beverly, yes. Talked about when we did the doctor's opinion. And as long as I'm going to get in trouble, we might as well get it all out. It says in the doctor's opinion, the only remedy we have is entire abstinence. And this word abstinence, I'm piggybacking off of what you're saying. This word abstinence is a word that can get O-A-ers in big trouble. We cannot really be abstinent in the sense of what the word means. The word abstinent means to abstain from or to avoid. If you've eaten any food at all today, you are not, by definition, abstinent. What I am looking for in my life, and I've lost over 500 pounds, what I am looking for in my life today is not abstinence. I am looking for sanity around my food and my relationship with food.
Amen.
Sanity. Sanity is the key. I'll get you in just 1 minute. 1 minute, Shannon. But it's sanity around my food. I'll be damned if I'm going to call John in California and say,
I know you're in a meeting, but I'm at lunch with Beverly and Jennifer, and I'm going to substitute the a nectarine here for an orange.
If you call me with that, I will hang up on you. He's here to get me. Okay.
All right. First of all, I haven't heard a word of it, but is this man not fantastic? Give him a hand. We are very honored that Harlan was kind enough to come in from Phoenix. He comes, he's like a barnacle. We have to scrape him off for the birthday party every year. But this year we got him to do this, and we really appreciate that. So just a couple quick announcements. We will be reconvening here at 2:00.